St. Louis. That's one part of the low-wage worker spectrum. We've got home care workers. We've got workers in retail. These workers need to change the context of these jobs, make them strong middle-class jobs. That's our work. That's our goal. This movement resonates so broadly across our community in terms of both workers and those who stand with workers in St. Louis and then across the nation. These workers are leading the charge, but this is a fight for all of us. There's a coalition of unions that are working to support this effort in Missouri, in St. Louis, and also we have a tremendous infrastructure for support of these workers through Missouri Jobs with Justice.
For the second time this month, Turkish labor unions have called a general strike to protest the harsh police actions against protesters in Istanbul's Taksim Square. Five trade union confederations began a one-day nationwide strike Monday, and are also calling on workers to take to the streets to protest government actions. During the last general strike in the first week of June, this unidentified Turkish protester told Canada's Radio Labor that economic injustice for workers, as Turkey's economy expands, is helping drive these protests.
So this is sort of like a 99% issue. The growth of the economy is creating more inequality in earnings and is therefore antagonizing the people.
Construction has come to a halt in the Canadian province of Quebec. Jesse Russell reports.
With contract negotiations between the Construction Association and unions who represent the workers falling apart this weekend, the construction workers walked off the job Monday morning. The strike impacts business, residential, industrial, and municipal construction. The association is seeking more authority when it comes to requiring employees to work on Saturdays, and they also want to create a 14-hour workday. Employers are also seeking to pay less for overtime. Currently, workers receive double time, but the employers want to only pay time and a half. More than 175,000 construction workers are walking the picket lines. Both sides have accused the other of bargaining in bad faith. This is the first construction strike in the province in 30 years.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor is union-owned, union-represented, and the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show on the road, the People's Tour for America going across country out to San Jose, California. Today we are in New Mexico on our way to Tempe, Arizona. Tonight on the big program we'll be talking about our time in Dallas. We were at Dealey Plaza, looked at the grassy knoll. Also, the Bush Library, which I have so been looking forward to since we announced this tour, Pat. And I've got Pat Lamar sitting in the side seat here. I've been really looking forward to the Bush Library.
It's a library. That's where they keep the books on nuclear arms. I still shake my head. He's like those big blow-up snowmen you get for Christmas, you know? Put it out on your lawn at the holidays, and someone pulled the plug, and he deflated and came back with this big, dumb library. But you're right. I was really looking forward to it, too. And
the greatest president in history.
I got to tell you, Sam, the greatest being only an adjective to a noun that needs to follow. But I'll tell you what, it did not disappoint.
No, it did not disappoint.
I'm an adrenaline junkie, and I had just about the maximum adrenaline exposure I could handle.
But the greatest president in the history of forever. At least that's what they'll tell you.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, where were the millions of foreclosures in the timeline? Where was the greatest economic disaster of the alleged greatest country on the planet?
The savior.
The decider.
No, not the decider. He's the, what I came away from with that is not just he's the savior.
Well, you know, that reminds me of a friend of mine who says, you have to scare the living daylights out of people, because if they don't know they need to be saved, they won't look for a savior.
Yep, and there he is.
Yeah. I tell you what, poor Laura Bush. I wrote a story once about Laura Bush and Jacqueline Kennedy, and I called it The Shaming of the Screws instead of The Taming of the Shrews.
I got it.
Actually, it was a title that the editor of Common Dreams gave it, John John from Common Dreams named it that, because, you know, these women did anything for those men and money. And when Laura Bush came out after the president was no longer president and said she was pro-gay marriage and all this other stuff, and she had just sat there and swallowed her own convictions. For what? To keep the worst president that was never elected?
Greatest president
never
ever
elected. Wasn't that amazing?
That was amazing.
Weren't you amazed that they had the fact that he wasn't actually elected
right
as like
front.
The opening? I know!
Right as you walk in, there it is.
The whole Florida recount, the whole fact that Sandra Day O'Connor was the only vote that mattered out of the millions of people that voted for Al Gore. I mean, Al Gore won the election, and they're not even ashamed of the fact that they stole it.
No. And I look at this and I go, you're right from the beginning, rewriting history and trying to legitimize. But there's so much to get to with the Bush Library, or as some have called it, the Library. Yeah.
Library. Just because he pronounces that way anyway, that's not an accident, mind you. And the fact that it's on Elm Street. And as we learned from Dealey Plaza, Elm Street's where John F. Kennedy was killed.
Right.
Could you be any more disrespectful?
It was a beautiful building, though.
If you like, Italian fascist architecture.
Wow.
Don't you think it looked like the stuff Mussolini built?
A little, sure.
I mean, the only thing missing was Mussolini.
Well,
no, he was kind of there, too.
Kind of there.
Mussolini inventing the word fascism, which is, of course, the corporate control of government.
But we're going to get into all of that as the program goes on, all of our thoughts on what we saw at the Bush Library. So much to get into. Much that was missing.
Books.
Books.
I mean, for everyone who wanted to know.
Did you really expect there to be books there?
Oh, come on. For everyone who wanted to know if the goat, whatever that was, the pet goat. No, that wasn't there. But there was not a single book in the library. Not one.
Sure there were. There were some kids' books on the sales rack. On the How Wonderful No Child's Behind Left was for the country. There were some books there. Dr. Seuss Hop on Pop was there.
What, in the bookstore?
In the display.
You mean in the
museum?
Where?
They had a whole big wall for No Child's Behind Left. And there was a little kids' bookshelf kind of thing with, yeah, and there was a doctor.
Really books. They were just the sawed off.
They were the covers. No, they were the covers.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were there.
Oh, for God's sake. It was appalling. Except that diamond necklace that someone gave to Condoleezza Rice. Oh, my God.
Italy.
That was beautiful on her, too. Yeah, Italy. Yeah. And I thought maybe Muammar Gaddafi gave it to her, because remember he had the hots for her?
Uh-huh.
You know?
He had the money.
he was really like, Condi, baby, come on over. Hey, look,
love that split.
Reagan bombed me. It can't possibly happen twice in the same place. Lightning don't strike twice in the same place. Come on, Condi. I'll hook you up. Yeah, just don't stay in the tent. That's where they killed my children.
Oh, right away, right there.
It's true. I always wanted to make a cartoon, except I can't draw. I wanted to make a cartoon strip back when Ronald Reagan was president, and I wanted all the little characters, all the political characters to be ants. You know, because I thought we could have Nancy Reagan, right? And we could have Muammar Gaddafi, and we could have all these different people. And then, of course, Reagan has to go and bomb Gaddafi's, you know, camp and kill his kid and everything. That kind of ruined the whole idea of a comic strip.
Well, I'll put him in his place. That's what we do.
You know, our oil companies were making so much money off of Libya when we bombed that place. I could not believe it. You know, yep. It was like, are we really going to go there with the oil companies? Like, why were we doing business with him?
Money.
That's appalling.
Do you need to ask that? And I got to be honest, on the fact of money, you know, and we'll talk a little bit later about it as well, but right when you walk in the door, the money people are right in your face.
What was that called? Like
a freedom wall.
Freedom wall? Oh, for the love of God. You know, I mean, it was the chiseled in stone names of people, and we couldn't find out how much they paid. We're supposed to be getting the contact for the foundation. The Foundation for Public Relations Lady.
Which is just an incestuous little pool of government and private interest. I mean,
If she ain't good enough for our family, she ain't good enough. No. She ain't good enough for her family, she ain't good enough for ours.
Yeah.
That's just that kind of incest. I know what, the Gates Foundation?
Diane Hendricks.
But the Gates Foundation, aren't they trying to pretend to be nice? I mean, isn't that what Bill Gates said? I married a Catholic so she can do the praying.
Well, yeah, and that's, who do you think pushed No Child's Dime Left? Who do you think pushed that all through? Who's pushing the whole privatization of education, the destruction of public education? Who do you think's doing that? It's people like Gates, with tools like Bush. And at the end of this, you know, I look at this, and again, you know, the other registry I want is the Freedom Registry. I mean, the word of the I was just taken by how many times you used the word freedom.
I want the word freedom back.
Yes.
You know, I want
the freedom to use the word freedom right.
Yeah, right. But you know what? We really blew it. We blew it. Although I just couldn't stand being there anymore, but we blew it. We didn't go in the cafe because we didn't find out if we had freedom fries.
Oh.
I mean, we didn't go in the cafe.
Oh. See, that was just you wanted to get out of there so quickly.
I wanted to get out of there so bad. And then your adorable little daughter said, we forgot to go to the Oval Office.
So we had to sneak back in.
No. So we went back in. And the Oval Office, first of all, the Oval Office in Clinton's library is the Oval Office he had. And everything in it is basically original except the desk, you know.
The desk stays.
And you can't go in it because it's his stuff.
Right.
But all of the Oval Office in George Bush's library is a replica. So they let all of these overly, I can't even describe these senior women, probably most of them in their 60s, with perfectly pressed gabardine pants, you know, all of them wearing their, what are those things called, you know, when the pants are shorter than your ankle?
Yeah, capris or
capri pants, yeah. And they're perfectly coiffed hair, and they're ridiculous layers of makeup, even though it was hotter than...
And their big Joker smile.
Yeah, and their big Joker...
With the makeup.
They did have big Joker smiles. And their crazy costume jewelry.
Yes.
And it was just kind of obscene. It was obscene. It was presidential porn.
That's a good way of putting it.
It was. It was. Can I bend you over the Lincoln statue? Did you see the Lincoln statue? I posted a picture of it up on Facebook. It's shamed Lincoln. He's looking down. Uh-oh. Oh, isn't that awful? See, that's what... That, you see, we're looking at something you can't see on the radio. We're driving through the desert Southwest, and they've got a brown family, meaning people of color, on the side of the road, and
stripping their vehicle.
Stripping their vehicle. And it is appalling to see this xenophobic, I mean, it's just awful. And we're not going to go far enough south to see the wall, but the wall is appalling.
I love the wall, though.
Ugh.
The wall created jobs.
You know what?
Both building the wall and building the ladders that are going to go over the wall.
I wish we would create jobs taking the wall down. The wall is a terrible
thing.
Not
against taking it down so we can put it right back up.
No.
We could just have that be an exercise.
You know what?
Up, down, up, down.
If you want to create jobs, let's get back to making something that'll get to the space station. I mean, depending on other countries to rescue our astronauts, that's absurd. If you want to get jobs, let's do that. This thing we're doing to people of color. And thankfully, the Supreme Court just said Joe Arpaio's a slob. I think they worded
it differently.
Well, we
knew that.
Yeah, but the Supreme Court agrees. And, you know, they're slobs half the time, so that was kind of impressive. You know, hey, he's one of us.
Wow. But anyway, back to the Bush Library. We're going to talk with one of their public relations people, who was a really nice guy.
John,
soon to be father, just a really super nice guy. But not somebody we went after. It was just information. To get, you know, we wanted to know what it cost to build the library, how many people come through, you know, that basic stuff.
Oh, you mean we weren't hard on him?
No, he couldn't be. He wasn't the guy to.
No,
he wasn't the guy to beat up with that.
It's that ever elusive chick who knows.
Yeah,
all
we
got
to get her.
Yeah, but he works for the federal government. He works for the archives, the National Archives, and they only take part. The thing I love about his job is he's only in charge of the truth. So their part of the library can't be seen by the public.
Right, and never going to be seen by the public
because they have the truth, and it's in behind. This the whole smoke and mirrors thing that's been built by the Bush Foundation or whatever the heck it's called. And so, you've been to Disney World?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so you know when you're riding on the haunted house?
Yep.
And you know when the haunted house goes by the mirror and then all of a sudden you see the ghosts in the car with you?
Yep.
Yeah, that's the Bush Library.
There you go.
It's not really there. It's all a bunch of fabrication. But if you look just right, it looks like it's real. And the real archives, the real truth, the real foreclosure information, the real war on terror, the real lack of yellow cake from Niger, that's another thing. They said that...
No tubes. I was expecting to see at least one tube.
I think they should have had Scooter Libby's handcuffs. How about his little orange outfit?
I wanted the cartoon drawings that Colin Powell took to the UN. That's what I wanted to see.
The cartoon drawings.
That's what they were.
I know.
They weren't actual photographs. They were drawings. This is what we think they look like.
This is what a mobile terror plant looks like. Mobile chemical facility looks like. But they had the hubris, the absolute brass, the kahunas, the truck bumper things we see flopping all over Texas. They had those to actually put that the Bush administration was about the eradication of weapons of mass destruction. They actually had that in the library.
Yep. He kept us safe.
Oh, for the
saved
love of God.
Saved us from terror.
Kept us safe. We've
saved us.
5,000 brave men and women that we put in harm's way in a war that was, well, you know all this, predicated on lies, and now another 5,000 have taken their own lives, not to mention all the traumatic brain problems, and then all the people we're ignoring, not giving their benefits to. I mean, if they wanted to make an appropriate tribute to what do you call that? Presidency.
Legacy.
Yeah. They should have just given him West Texas.
Absolutely.
Here's your bomb crater. Just put a sign up that says, "Welcome to the George Bush Library."
That would be.
Call it good.
And in the second hour, we're going to talk about our visit to West Texas, not the west side of Texas, actually the city of West Texas, the one back on April the 18th, I believe it was, had a massive explosion that killed 15 and injured, I think, 100 other people. And the way you look at it, we'll talk about it later, it could have been much, much worse. Going to take a quick break. We're going to come back from the road, the People's Tour for America. You can follow us where we're going, where we've been, peoplestourforamerica.com. Back from the road. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Yeah.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Nothing.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com, or you could follow us on the road. Find out where we've been, where we're going, peoplestourforamerica.com. We're on the road, literally on the road, going across country. I've got Pat Lamar sitting shotgun. Pat, what a beautiful night.
It is absolutely beautiful and possibly the windiest thing I've ever driven through, packing that much sand.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've been through a sandstorm that was, it obscured every mountain.
But what beautiful scenery. What an amazing country we live in. I mean, the beauty of so many different areas, just breathtaking.
It is breathtaking. It's hard to believe that there are people who are born and live in an area and never leave it, you know. It's amazing. When Katrina happened, 40% of the people in Louisiana had never been out of the state. 80% of the people that lived in New Orleans had never been out of the state. To see something like this is just amazing, and to think it's not shared by people, which is why we want you to share it. So go to the website, see the pictures that we're posting. I mean, we're having a great time, and we're talking about some important stuff, but it's also an opportunity for you to sort of hijack the trip and tag along and see some of this beauty that we're seeing.
Absolutely. And while we were in Dallas, one of the stops we had to make was the grassy knoll, and we spent some good time there. But we had to go to the Bush Library. And, you know, we called in advance, played phone tag for quite some time with their public relations guy. What was his, John Orwell?
John Orell.
John Orell, he's their public relations guy. And, you know, couldn't have been nicer once we got there. In fact, took us to the decider room.
He did.
We got to go into the actual situation room that they dismantled and recreated right there in the library.
Now, he was saying that George Bush would, set aside things so that his aides could take them and save them for the library. So, like, when he was done with the bullhorn at 9/11, standing on top of the rubble with the first responders that he was going to turn his back on when they needed health care, and Michael Moore was going to have to take them to Cuba to get it. But when he was standing there with him and he had the bullhorn, and he said, yep, well, people are going to hear us. People who did this are going to hear from us. Yes, they are. And then he handed the bullhorn off to an aide who said, okay, this is good for the library. Well, he remodeled the Situation Room in 2007, and he said, boys, keep that paneling. Hear what I have to say? Keep that paneling. And those chairs, yeah, the one, especially that one that Dick Cheney broke with a great big lard ass. Make sure you save that chair. Yep, that one. And Rummy, he's always, you know, he's always sitting on the arm of that thing. Make sure you save that.
Now,
Condi.
All the original chairs, except for the
Condi's chair. Condi's chair can go with me. Know what I'm saying? I got a special place for Condi's chair.
We're
the lines. I'm not making this up.
It was all right there. We got.
I'm making it up, but it probably is true.
We got to sit right there in the decider room. And I got to be honest, though, from a historical standpoint, didn't you feel a little something where you're going, you know, I'm sitting in a room where really a lot of really bad decisions were made?
Yeah, it was the same room. I mean, that room had been in effect since the 80s, so Ronald Reagan was in there blowing it. I mean, you know, and not to use the same verb, but Clinton.
Yeah. But that was the Oval Office. You know,
you think? You think that was a wandering trip?
Yeah, it could have been.
Yeah.
Although I think the Situation Room, maybe.
Situation, how do you think it got
there's the situation.
Calvin Coolidge put the back door on the White House, technically the back door, so that he could get his mistress in.
I mean,
come on. You don't
and
think
I'm not against that.
You don't think...
If it's going to stop the next war, I'm all in favor.
Really? Keep
if
that going
to If it's going to lead to good policies, if it's going to lead to maybe... you know, the president reaching out and touching a common person, well, I'm okay with it.
Is that what it was, mixing with the common folk?
The unwashed masses.
She looks very tidy. Monica, tidy. Clean, clean girl.
Part of the masses.
Oh, my.
But that's how it is. Anyway, yeah. we interviewed John Orwell.
I got to tell you, though, I didn't see any reference to Monica in Clinton's library.
Nor would there. The blue dress wasn't there?
No, but so maybe, I heard it was at the dry cleaners. But maybe, finally.
You think if you had paid for dry cleaning, we wouldn't be in this mess.
Oh, for God's sake, they'd have done anything they could. I love that bumper stickers that during the Bush administration that said, would someone please give him a job so that we could impeach him?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
But
no one was willing.
Ooh. Anyway, this is the interview we did with John Orwell, the public relations guy. Interesting interview.
If you could you just go over your capacity here again, that you basically work for the archive and not for the library or the foundation or whatever?
Well, the best way to explain it is that you have the overall entity, which is the Bush Center. That's the entire facility that this is in. It's split almost right down the middle. Part of it's the Bush Institute and Foundation. The other part is the Library and Museum. The Library and Museum, they're run by the National Archives and Records Administration. That's where I fit in. I am an employee of the National Archives and Records Administration. So for the Library and Museum, I handle all the public relations and all the marketing from that side of the house.
Is that common for a presidential library? I've been to several, and I don't recall them being separated out. Government component and a foundation component.
13 of them are that way. We have 13 within the National Archives system. The first one was created by FDR. Our oldest one, not old as far as the age of the museum, but as far back as the presidents go, that'd be the Hoover Museum, because he was still alive when FDR had his commission, and he goes, well, I'd like to have one as well.
A dam wasn't enough.
Yeah, exactly. So it is a partnership. It's been a partnership that's been running now since the FDR times. There are other presidential libraries out there. I've been to the Lincoln one. I'm from Illinois. I've been to the Lincoln one in Springfield. That's actually run by state historical societies. And when you have Monticello and Mount Vernon, those are run by certain foundations and societies. They're not attributed to, or I don't mean attributed, but they're not working in conjunction with the National Archives. So this is part of the Presidential Records Act. The reason this is this way is because the National Archives maintains all of the presidential record keeping. So the museum is the artifacts that are collected throughout the presidency, and then the library is all of the paperwork, all of the emails, all the photos, all the videos that are collected throughout a president's term. And then we maintain those and we open them up to the public for research and however the American people would like to use those records.
So we're in a rebuilt situation room. Would that have been done by the archives, or is that part of the center?
Well, the best way to say it is that the White House historians, they work with the National Archives. So when they... A great example would be 9/11. So 9/11, President Bush, you know, right after 9/11, President Bush is there down at Ground Zero, and he's talking on the bullhorn. You know, that's a very, it's a very famous scene. There's somebody there that's always on the staff that has the foresight to say, we need to hold on to this. So he comes down off the rubble, and there's usually a staffer there that goes, sir, you know, may I please have this? And then they'll hold on to it. And then that's how it becomes part of the National Archives. So this room, how that happened is when the administration remodeled it in 2007, they had the foresight to say, let's hold on to this, let's keep it in storage, and let's see how we can utilize this. So we actually, you know, there's two rooms. We just didn't have space for two rooms. So we put a call out to the other directors of the other 13 presidential libraries, and the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California said, oh, we would love to have the other portion. So there's actually two rooms. We've got the conference room, and then the war room is out there in Simi Valley with the Reagan Library.
And that's the thing you're going to coordinate for students. We'll get to that in a second. But so does President Obama, like, not have a room? Is it just sort of sheetrock there now? I mean, because all the paneling's here?
Oh no. They did a full remodel. So you've actually seen the room. If you remember the day that Osama bin Laden was killed, you see those photos where everybody's sitting around that table. That's the White House Situation Room right there.
So how did they get, I mean, you said these are the chairs and the, I know I'm stuck on this, but so was this what it was before they remodeled it?
Yep, exactly. That's what this was. This was the Situation Room. Think of all the decisions that happened sitting right where you're sitting at the president's end of the table. I mean, there's so many historical things that happened in this room, so many historical conversations that happened in this room. It's just been transplanted.
Literally, these walls could talk.
Exactly.
So but when we walked in here, you said, you know, we rebuilt this room. And my first thought was, you know, did we tear these off the walls? Does every president do this? Do we have to remodel every time you have a change in administration?
No, it doesn't happen every administration. What happened was the technology moved forward. They wanted to get a little more technologically advanced within the Situation Room, and there's only so much that they could do in here. There's actually false walls where if we open them up, TVs can go in there. But there's not a lot of the ability to really move forward with the technology. So when they decided to beef up towards those technological advances, that's when they did a full remodel. Usually the room that the president remodels every administration is the Oval Office. That's the one that they have. And then, of course, every First Lady, she'll do a personal touch on certain rooms throughout the White House, but it doesn't happen with every. So we're very fortunate, and so are the students that are going to get to participate this. And whenever we do get the opportunity to finally open this up to the public, which we're not sure how we're going to be able to do it, because unfortunately, you know, your listeners can't see it, but this is a very small room. So try to think about putting 2,000 people through here in a day. Logistically, it's not going to be that easy. So we'd love to bring everybody in here. We just don't know if we're going to have the ability to.
That's how many people come here every day, 2,000, because the line was out the door when we came in.
Well, I'll tell you, so we've been open since May 1, and we've had 75,000 visitors now. So we had just about 60 in the first month. It's a little bit above what we were looking for. When we estimated the numbers, we actually estimated that we'd probably get between 45 and 50 in our first month. So the fact that we had 60, I think, is a testament that folks wanted to come out and just see what we had to offer. So
now, as you come in, there's a wall with the list of people who have made contributions. How much do you have to contribute to get on the wall? Because there's also what was it called, the freedom list or something of people who have given money, but obviously didn't make it to the wall.
You know, I actually can't speak to that because that's a foundation thing. The National Archives side of the house, we are not involved in the fundraising at all. The best way to understand how this building is broken down, when a visitor comes in, when you first enter in, you see the list of names there. You see the freedom list. You also walk into what's called Freedom Hall. So that's all George W. Bush Presidential Foundation property. So where the admissions desk is, where we'll see the video at, that's all foundation property. That's theirs to do with as they please. The parts that actually belong to the National Archives that the foundation has donated to the National Archives would be the museum space, would be the temporary museum space, would be where researchers room, the research room, the Situation Room, which you're sitting in now, the National Archives office space is where all the employees work, and then below the museum floor level, below the main floor that you walk in, it's just row after row after row of paperwork stacks. So it's where all of our storage for the artifacts and for all of the papers. That's all National Archives. So as far as anything else goes, the foundation side of the house, the courtyard, the restaurant, the museum shop, and Freedom Hall, including that front entryway where the fountain is, that's all foundation property.
Now, if when you come into work, and that was one of my questions, is you've got stacks and stacks of paperwork downstairs, and I was at the Clinton Library where they have the stacks, you know, they probably have more than you can see, but they have the stacks of information. For you or President Clinton or back even to Carter, the 50 years hasn't gone by yet for disclosing of information that's been national security. So how much can you archive? I mean, can you only get the stuff that's basically been on the front page of the New York Times anyway?
Well, the best way to understand it is since the end of the presidency, we've been following under a cooperation with the Presidential Records Act. And I could put you in contact with an archivist that would really be the subject matter expert on this. But what I can answer is that right now, we have about 200,000 documents that are open to the public. from all different topics. One of the bigger topics is the No Child Left Behind. What's going to happen is on January 20th, 2014, we have past the five-year mark of the end of the Bush presidency, and that's when the Freedom of Information Act will kick in. So what's going to happen then is anybody can put a written Freedom of Information Act request in on whatever topic they'd like. As far as the release of information, yeah, you're correct. We're still within that 50-year span, so what will be redacted from any documents will be personal identifiable information. So we're talking Social Security, birth dates, addresses, anything like that. Those would be removed from all documents and from all emails. And then anything having to do with national security will be redacted as well. So
that's okay. We can get that from Facebook.
So what is the focus of your work then here? Do you focus mainly on domestic policy, foreign policy? What's the focus of the museum side of this? What's the message we're sending people?
Well, the one thing that we're really trying to be is the purveyors of history. I will tell you that I've had comments from both sides of the fence. We've had folks that have come in and they're very negative towards the presidency. We've had folks that have come in and they're very positive towards the presidency. And I think both of them left almost with the same feeling that they learned something. I'm not here to try and change anybody's mind. I work for the National Archives. We are a nonpartisan federal entity. So we're not here to change your mind. We're just here to educate you. One of the things I really take pride in is that we do spend some time on showing you what it's like to be the president. Not just President Bush, but what it's like to be the president. One of the places where you really get into that is the Decision Points Theater. And I highly recommend any guests that come here take the time to do that. It's about an 8-minute, fully interactive situation. You sit down. And you've got four scenarios. And now, they are four scenarios that President Bush had during his presidency, and that's the surge, the rise of Saddam Hussein, the financial crisis, and Hurricane Katrina. So those are pretty four hot topic, you know, situations that happened during the presidency. And what you get the opportunity to do is you get the opportunity to sit there, and you're given advice from both sides of the aisle. You're given advice from every kind of... So like the CIA, the FBI, the military, White House advisors, now these are all hypothetical folks giving hypothetical scenarios or hypothetical advice. But what you have to do is you have to sit there, you have to listen to their advice and say, I agree with this or I disagree with this. And so that's similar to the line of what a president has to do. The president gets the facts and goes, I agree with this or I disagree with what you're saying. And then at the end, you make a final decision and say, okay, so as far as when, great example would be the Hurricane Katrina. You know, should you send in federal troops with arresting authority? Should you send in federal troops to help, you know, the local National Guard and local authorities, or should you use the Insurrection Act? So you have to make a decision then on one of those three scenarios. If you were the president right now, what would you do? And that's really one of the things that we're trying to do is. We want to educate folks on the Bush presidency, but we also want to educate folks on what it means to be the president.
So these are hypothetical. We wouldn't be able to say this is actually the advice he got.
No, you wouldn't get that. It's the actual scenarios, but not the actual advice, no.
So where does this advice come from? I mean, if it's not what he got, then where does it come from? Because you could make the argument that what you're being offered is false choices.
Well...
I don't want to get into the whole political thing, but I just want to know where the information came from.
We had script writers. Okay. We had script writers. The folks who designed the program for us worked with folks here at the National Archives and in the Bush Foundation, and we had script writers that just came up with the scenarios and came up with the different arguments. And you'll see it.
I'm actually looking forward to that portion of it.
Yeah, you haven't had a chance yet. You'll see. I think a really good example is, and I go back to the Katrina because I've done that scenario so many times, and I go to the military aspect of it. You know, you have a member of the military going on one side going, we need to send in troops with federal arresting powers. This has to happen, and gives this whole long list. Then you go to the other side right there on the same screen. It goes, you can't send federal troops in with arresting powers. They haven't been trained for this. They're not. So you get both sides of that, and that's. I think you're really going to see that when you go in. It's right there. It gives you both sides of the information, and lets you make your mind up with how you want to go.
And that's one of the big criticisms of this library that I've seen from editorial writers is that It is so electronic. It's not a library like the 19th century would have thought of a library. You know, it's not any library I've been to. I've only been to five presidential libraries, but you know, you walk in, they're like, they're a little bit like the Smithsonian, but except for pushing a button every now and then, there's no interaction. And this is, we haven't seen it yet, but such an electronic library that they're saying, well, it's video game reality. It's not bringing people to the real thing. What's the answer to that?
Well, I would highly disagree with that as far as not bringing reality to folks. We are interactive, but think of what happened in the 8 years. I mean, think of the changes. We've become an electronic society. And so, yes, the museum is more interactive than the Clinton Museum, but the Clinton Museum is also more interactive than Bush 41 Museum, and Bush 41 is more interactive than... You see where I'm going with this? With the change in the presidency, there was a change in technology. I can't say I guarantee you because I'm not part of the planning process, but it's a safe bet to say that the Obama Library is going to be even more interactive because of the change in technology. But as far as... What was the second part that you said with folks? That one of the criticisms were that they felt that it was too video game-ish, that we were... I accept all opinions. I do. And I mean, the best thing for me to say is that I have to be right down the middle of the road with you guys. I'm not going to change your mind. I'm not here to change your mind. We are not here to change your mind. We understand folks are going to come in with preconceived notions, both on the right and the left. There's going to folks that come in and say, I love President Bush so much. There's nothing you could ever tell me that's going to change my mind. That's fine. We're not here to change your mind. There's also going to be folks that come in and say, I hate President Bush so much, there's nothing you can do to change my mind. That's fine. We're not here to change your mind. We're here to educate you. We're here to let you learn more. Whether you like it or you don't like what you learn, that's up to you. We can't change it. That's one of the beauties that God gave us, free will, choice.
You know, my second grade teacher told my mother, people will love Patty or they'll hate Patty, but nobody will say, I don't remember Patty. And that seems to be that's the case for President Bush, too. It's like, okay, they love him or they hate him, but I bet you don't get too many people coming in here and saying, who is this? Whose library?
Yeah, no, we definitely haven't anybody poke their head and say, I was actually looking for a bathroom, but what do we have going on here, folks? What is this? No, we haven't had that one yet, no.
Let's talk about the building of this this structure. You know, do we know what conditions it was built under? Was there a project labor agreement? Did they? I know the president wasn't big. No idea there.
That's all foundation stuff. As far as the construction goes, the only thing I can say is we are LEED Platinum certified.
That I was shocked. I wrote that down, in fact, because you know, I wanted to ask. How much money are you saving by being LEED Platinum certified? Because what that means is the most efficient forms of energy, the least amount of energy use. All the design is to save the environment in the building of it, and then to save energy usage as it's used. Everything from low flow toilets to everything. In order to be LEED Platinum certified, this is probably one of the most environmentally friendly buildings in the United States, and I wrote it down because I was like, holy Moses, that's got to be about the money.
Well, no, I mean, those were the two questions I had, the building conditions, who built it, was it union labor used, you know, what that was, and then, of course, the energy efficiency stuff. Since
here's the reason I don't know this information is that process, that happening, that's all pre-National Archives. Our director is there for the building meetings. He's there. But as far as the companies that the foundation chose, how and why they chose them, that's all up to the Bush Foundation because they haven't signed that property over to us. When that happened, when this became our building, was April 24th, the day before the dedication. The foundation sat down, they signed a joint use agreement, said, we now donate that much part of the land to the National Archives, and that's when that became. So
you're going to give us the contact information for the, and we can call her and ask. I did notice there is a Manhattan construction company on one of the massive donors, one of the cast in stone donors. I'm going to call them the Fred Flintstone donors because, you know, they're in stone. but so who knows, maybe a pile of the construction was donated, you know, or maybe that was something left over from 9/11. But those would be interesting questions to have answered. I'd love to get a list of the Patriot list, just to.
Is there a way to get a copy of the list of donors?
I'll put you in contact with the director of communications for the foundation, and they can tell you that part. Again, that is out of the National Archives realm right there. So
it's really interesting that the building of the building was done by the foundation, and then it's just donated to.
is that something that's normal? Yeah, interesting.
Is there anything else that we're?
What would you suggest we see?
The top three lists that I always break down, and this is in no particular order because I can't pick a favorite yet. I always say one of our biggest draws is the Oval Office. It's a fully replicated two-size Oval Office. The only other kind of Oval Office that you can walk in and sit on the couches like that is the one there in Pennsylvania Avenue in D.C. And trust me, that's not open to the public. So, one thing we really take pride in.
So we can go in this Oval Office? Because, you know, you can't go in the one in the Clinton Library.
You can go in there. You can sit on the chairs. I go in there every day. I sit down at the seat next to where the president usually sits there by the couches. I'll have a guest. Usually a kid will come in. I'll be like, all right, Madam or Mr. President, I'm the Secretary of Pizza. You know, it's a good way.
Can we have pizza?
Not in the library space, man. There's no food or drinks allowed.
Dang it.
So that's one of our big ones. For me personally, I really enjoy the Worldwide Health Initiative portion. They really get into PEPFAR. PEPFAR really gets left behind in the dust because it got signed into action in 2003. I think we can all remember as Americans what was going on historically during 2003. And so one thing you're going to see is you see a breakdown of the world map broken down by the continents. Now, we give you the actual map in one portion where you can see what the continents actually look like, and then you get to look at another map, and it's called the Faces of HIV. And the continents are on that map are the size, and you'll see it's the size of a wall. The continents that size are in relation to the number of HIV cases that continent has. And so when you look down and you see Africa, and you see just how overgrown and bloated it is on that atlas, it really, I think, brings to your mind. And when you think about changes in the world, and again, this is personally affects me because I have friends that are living with HIV. We never say dying of HIV. We say living with HIV. When you think about a few $100 million compared to now $48 billion being spent on AIDS research, prevention, and education there in Africa, I think that's, to me, that's one of my favorite parts. I always like to stop there. Any tour that I take, whether it's family, friends, or media, I always stop by there.
And even the most radical, some of the most radical of liberal people I know who work on world health issues, when you mention the Bush legacy and the HIV work, they fall to their knees. It really is the point where I believe in the yin and the yang, right? There's nothing all good and nothing all bad, but that's the one thing that everybody can agree on was, and really underspoken of.
Yeah, it definitely gets left behind when you talk historically. And I think the biggest compliment to that program is Dedication Day, when you had all five presidents there, outside, of course, his father, Bush 41, who didn't speak very long, but the other four who did speak, every single speech had something about PEPFAR in their speech. Every single one of them said something about PEPFAR. So,
did his dad mention why he wasn't saying much? No. All right. I didn't mean that to be a bad question.
you have to understand, when I was growing up, when he was president, I was 8 years old when he was president. And so that's that age where you start to go, what do I want to do when I grow up? I want to be a firefighter. I just remember watching his dad on TV, and I don't know anything about politics at that age, but I wanted to be the president. So I fell in love with that president. That was my president. You know, Reagan was when I was really coming, you know, I was birth to eight. Communism, I barely remember that. I mean, I'm that generation that barely remembers communism. But and this is all total off topic, but the reason I didn't answer that question is because I got emotional. When he talked, I actually cried. I don't cry very often. And I remember the curator elbowed me because it wasn't like a tear. It was a, you know, sitting there at my chair. And I don't know why. I think it was just an emotional connection that I felt that this is the first time I was really in that man's presence. And it was just an emotional thing for me. So I actually didn't hear a single word he said because I had bees going off in my ears the whole time. So
I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in the presence of five United States presidents. I mean, we're totally on your side. There's not one of us here who was in a total media political junkie. So it would have been pretty remarkable.
Yeah, love them or hate them, I mean, that's history. Yeah. You are living history, and I love that. I love it.
You know, you're very young. You can still be president.
My mother would beg to differ.
They don't talk about the baseball that went through the window. Honest, you're going to skate on that one. Any other questions, Rick?
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together there is power in a union on many lands. Power!
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
One is the free world. We sent our sons to Korea and Vietnam. Now we're wondering what they were dying for. Vietnam's
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. On the road, the People's Tour for America. We're going through New Mexico, and what a beautiful, beautiful night here in western New Mexico.
Oh my God, that sunset! You really can't see the sunset because it's already dropped down behind the mountains, but the sunlight is reflecting off the clouds, and it's breathtaking. Absolutely. And all of these mountain ranges, they almost look pretend, don't they?
I think, like you said a little earlier during the break, a series of cardboard cutouts.
Yeah. All you need is little ducks to go by, and you can do that duck game. You know, it looked like they could go in between them. At that sunset, though, you know, I know I'm the tree-hugging hippie freak rabid environmentalist in the crowd, but how anyone could, even just out of laziness, do anything to impact the environment that is so beautiful and fragile. I mean, the fact that this globe manages to stay between two temperatures that human beings can endure, like 20 below for the most part and 120 degrees, it doesn't boil up to 300, it doesn't go down to 500 below, you know? How can you take this sort of majesty for granted?
Well, I think as Rex Tillerson said, no matter what happens, we can engineer our way out of it. We can figure it out one way or another.
Whatever. Tell that
we've adapted. We're a species that has adapted. That's why we're here.
Tell that to the Mayans. The Mayans, who in Central America, overpopulated, consumed too much of their own resources, causing a drought, and then vanished. That's why there are all those temples down there and no people in places like Belize, where all the temples are completely overgrown. The roads aren't even visible anymore in the jungle because the people vanished because they wiped themselves out with being overly consumptive, like a virus, just a big old virus.
You know, one of the things, and going back to our conversation with John Orwell, you know, one of the things that still stuck with me is the relationship between the National Archive and the Bush Center or the Bush Institute or whatever it is, that, you know, I look at it and I go, okay, the Bush billionaire backers built this palatial cartoon, if you will, this propaganda center.
Yeah.
And then you're going to put someone, you know, an entity that's fairly, that is extremely nonpartisan, that's just looking at what is, in the same building without any clear demarcation line. I felt really, I don't know how you felt about it, but I felt really uneasy about that.
Yeah. And to have a man as the PR director who you could admire so incredibly, Iraq war veteran, still active duty, still, well, I guess he's off active duty, but he's in the National Guard, still a member of the National Guard, had guard weekend last weekend.
And that was an interesting story. He's down in Dallas, and his guard unit is up in St. Louis, and he goes back.
Yeah, because he loves his buddies. He loves those guys. They went to war together. They've come back together. They have gone through everything together, and he doesn't want to transfer guard units. And he was just an amazing man, federal employee, because he works for the archives. And like you said, it's like having meat and potatoes with cotton candy wrapped around it. You know, it's not good for you. It's all fluff and fake. And the real substance you can't see for all this cotton candy craziness. Monsanto cotton candy, by the way, made out of corn
syrup. Genetically modified.
Yeah, not sugar, just corn syrup.
But, you know, I look at the Bush monument. I don't even know, the museum, not even the right word. Because, you know, with a museum, you expect, at least I expect, some integrity.
Yeah.
Some measure of reality.
It's like shameless, too. It's shameless.
You know, one of the things that, you know, in the interview we had talked about is the PEPFAR, which is, you know, his plan for AIDS relief in Africa, which, you know, I think we both agree was, on a certain level, was one of the things we agreed with him on. But while we were sitting there talking about it, my immediate memory, because look, we lived, this is recent history, we lived through this presidency. My memory of it was, yeah, you spent a lot of money and you did some good things, but you made the problem worse by not teaching them about birth control and by defunding condom programs. And to me, that just seems like, okay, we're going to fix the problem after it's created.
Right. They wanted to have medicine for the disease, but they didn't want to stop the spread of the disease.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, some cynics would say, well, you know, he passed prescription D plan. Was this about the drug companies, or was it really about, you know, the faith-based initiatives that they loved to talk about? And when we come back in the second hour, maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because
yeah.
I'm interested in that perspective, because, you know, as I look at it, you go, okay, well, you know, the faith-based initiative stuff, yeah, you got to give them a little bit of credit pandering to the people who want to do good work, while on the other hand, you know,
It was to save widows and orphans, but we can talk about that later. He was a man who was controlled by, he even said God spoke to him, and obviously God told him to worry about those widows and orphans.
Yeah, good point. I'm going to take a quick break on the People's Tour for America as we're trucking down the road here in western New Mexico. Quick break, right back. People'sTourForAmerica.com. Back after this.
On the radio, with my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The battles for higher wages and union rights being waged around the country by fast food workers, retail workers, Walmart warehouse workers, and port workers is part of a dynamic new low-wage worker movement in America. From New York City to St. Louis, from Milwaukee to Chicago to Detroit, and to L.A. and beyond, workers assisted by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW are standing up for higher wages and the right to form unions. Martine Raffanon is with the St. Louis Workers Organizing Committee and the St. Louis Can't Survive on 735 campaign.
There are 36,000 fast food jobs in St. Louis. That's one part of the low-wage worker spectrum. We've got home care workers. We've got workers in retail. These workers need to change the context of these jobs, make them strong middle-class jobs. That's our work. That's our goal. This movement resonates so broadly across our community in terms of both workers and those who stand with workers in St. Louis and then across the nation. These workers are leading the charge, but this is a fight for all of us. There's a coalition of unions that are working to support this effort in Missouri, in St. Louis, and also we have a tremendous infrastructure for support of these workers through Missouri Jobs with Justice.
For the second time this month, Turkish labor unions have called a general strike to protest the harsh police actions against protesters in Istanbul's Taksim Square. Five trade union confederations began a one-day nationwide strike Monday, and are also calling on workers to take to the streets to protest government actions. During the last general strike in the first week of June, this unidentified Turkish protester told Canada's Radio Labor that economic injustice for workers, as Turkey's economy expands, is helping drive these protests.
So this is sort of like a 99% issue. The growth of the economy is creating more inequality in earnings and is therefore antagonizing the people.
Construction has come to a halt in the Canadian province of Quebec. Jesse Russell reports.
With contract negotiations between the Construction Association and unions who represent the workers falling apart this weekend, the construction workers walked off the job Monday morning. The strike impacts business, residential, industrial, and municipal construction. The association is seeking more authority when it comes to requiring employees to work on Saturdays, and they also want to create a 14-hour workday. Employers are also seeking to pay less for overtime. Currently, workers receive double time, but the employers want to only pay time and a half. More than 175,000 and construction workers are walking the picket lines. Both sides have accused the other of bargaining in bad faith. This is the first construction strike in the province in 30 years.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor is union-owned, union-represented, and the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. God is a
and welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of tonight's program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. That goes for the rest of the tour. If you missed any of our tour, it's all right there at PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. We've also got links at therickSmithShow.com. Lots to see, lots to do. If anything, you got something you caught your ear, something you want to tell us, if you got a suggestion of where we should eat in one of the cities across the country, rick@therickSmithShow.com. We appreciate all input. I got Pat Lamar sitting in the shotgun seat as we go trucking down the road, 75 legal miles an hour.
And we are approaching the fair state of Arizona.
Welcome to Arizona.
100 years old. Isn't that young?
Extremely. I think there are buildings in Carlisle older than 100 years old.
Oh, yeah, lots of them. Lots and lots.
The building that you're going to buy.
Yeah, that one with the cannonball holes in it.
Yeah.
The courthouse.
There you go.
150 years ago they got those holes. Coming right up. You know, we are missing that 150th anniversary of Gettysburg.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But I got to be honest with you. I like this tour.
Oh, me too.
I'm enjoying this. It's been a learning experience for me, as someone who, you know, I've seen a lot of the different states. I've been a lot of places. To experience this, it's one of those things where you want to go back and you go, I wish I'd have done this younger. And everyone should have the opportunity to do
this. You should be as old as me.
Someday I will be.
You did do it younger. Younger than me.
Younger than you.
Yeah. I know, and I'm really, you know, there's going to be a companion book to this. If you've got relatives that don't like radio or hate the internet and you can't get them to hang on for the podcast, although I have a feeling the last couple of days were worth it because we've kind of come a little unglued. That could be seven people in the tiny little space. You know, who knows what it is, but it sure is fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
There will be a book coming out in early fall, and as that starts to foment in my brain here, I'm thinking I am so grateful that I've gotten to meet the people we've interviewed. You know, they're the people who ought to have presidential libraries.
Absolutely.
They're the people who somebody ought to run around and collect the things that they handled when they were, you know, cleaning the streets or driving the truck or, you know, engineering the train or doing all the things that kept America running. They're the people who deserve a library, and so they're going to get one little book, but it is going to be the book of the story of this trip and the people that we met, and so that'll be available. We'll let you know when, hopefully soon.
Let's get to it. You got to get to it. We spent time in Dallas. You got to talk about the Bush Propaganda Center. I've been looking forward to the trip to that building from the day that we announced we were doing this tour. That was the place I go, we have got to go and see how history is being rewritten right before our very eyes. And, you know, you walk right into the building, there, right smack in front of you, the people who own the country, the real people who run this country. It wasn't the guy whose name's on the building out front. He was just the tool that the people who bought that building, he was the tool that they used to do their bidding.
Yep, and they're all there, and the big, big, big spenders, high rollers, they're carved in stone.
Chiseled in stone, and then, of course, you've got the Digital Freedom Registry, which I love. I love the word, love the use of the word freedom.
I want that word back. They can't use it anymore. That's our word. They've taken patriot and freedom, and I just realized on this trip that patriot is Pat Riot, which I'm going to pitch.
There you go.
Pat Riot, if they keep stealing our words. The Freedom Registry, the names of people who've been suckered and bamboozled into handing over money. I bet it's like televangelists shaking you down for an extra $5.
$16 to get into the Bush Propaganda Center. $16. We went so you don't have to. And at the end of it, look.
The Pepto-Bismol ran out.
And, you know, the thing is, you know, for those of us who lived through the Bush years, it was a comic strip more than anything, I think, in my view. Because as you walked in, and as we said earlier, as you walk in, you see a rewriting of the election of 2000. And I remember right there as you walk into the building, into the museum part or the propaganda part, the words in huge font, a charge to keep. Do you remember that phrase that he used? And it was, you know, he gave the speech after Gore conceded and said, oh, I'm going to be president for everyone, and I'm a uniter, not a divider. And then what happened?
Oh, I mean, it just nauseates me so much. First of all, the day it opened was May Day. It was May 1st, 2013, and for him to open it on International Labor Day just frosted my cookies. And when John told us that in the Situation Room, my spine snapped, all the little vertebrae clicked into place because I was like, oh,
yep.
That stuff doesn't happen by accident.
That was a thumb in the eye.
When they urinate on your grandfather's grave, you know they did it on purpose. That's what that was. Thumbing the eye being a little more polite way to put it.
And what's interesting is there was, in my look, there was nothing really there about jobs. There was nothing there to talk about what he did for the middle class or workers, other than the tax cuts. And even you look at the numbers that they used, skewed at best.
Well, that was the other thing. He showed a $1,200 check, but everybody got a $300 check. Like a handful of people got a $1,200 check. So that was hilarity. But to go back, I didn't mean to take you off what you said, because you said that we walked in, you walk in the beginning, and there's the illegal election, right? The selection of the president by Sandra Day O'Connor. And
who has now said she kind of regrets it.
Yes, even she regrets it. And I didn't think she had a conscience. Florida recount, I thought that the title of that whole thing, and that's what they even say, Florida recount. Like, would you brag about that? Would you go home and brag? My girlfriend turned me down before she waited for somebody better, and then when he didn't show up, she finally took my date to the prom. I mean, would you brag about that? Florida recount, I thought it should be titled The Illegal Presidency Remembered.
Yeah, you know? But you got to remember, this is his rewriting of history. This is the legacy through the most ardent supporters' eyes. This museum, this propaganda center, is not made for you or me, Pat. It's made for the most ardent supporters, the people who, no matter what Bush did, was going to, he's my president, I love him, I miss him.
I miss him, yeah. I miss him, too. I miss poking fun at him, but luckily they have the library, so that reinvigorated it. So, anyway, if these are the people that love him that did this, this is the quotation they put up of him. Okay, this is a quotation to prove that Albert Einstein ran the country. This is
you
what
you misunderstood me.
This is so absolute. See Dick shoot his friend in the face. I heard somebody said they're doing new Dick and Jane books. Okay, no. To stand for office, you must stand for something. This is the genius sentence they plucked out of 8 years of a presidency.
That's deep.
To put in that room where they recount.
Philosophers are going to be studying that for generations.
To stand for office, you must stand for something. I nearly wept.
Did he get that off of like a
restroom
wall?
Fortune cookie?
Off a restroom wall in a truck stop somewhere? Is that where that comes from?
You turn the corner, and there is a 14-foot piece of wreckage, a twisted girder from the World Trade Center. Our nation,
which I consider a failure.
Oh, yeah.
A massive failure.
Especially because...
But Pat,
Leslie
he
Clark,
kept us safe. George kept us safe, except for that. And, you know, I guess if you make the argument that he kept us safe... To put that in, you know, kind of maybe, is that some reality? That maybe on that day he, you know, took the day off? You know, he was off, you know, clearing brush?
Well, he was off the month before. Remember, he had the month of August off. Comes back to work, and all hell breaks loose. The twisted girder wreckage, and Wesley Clark, who was a Republican, who was in the National Security Council under Clinton, becomes a Democrat to run against George Bush in 2004, because when George Bush came in, he told Wesley Clark to pack his things, that he wasn't needed anymore. When Wesley Clark was saying, we've got this intelligence that says they're going to want to fly planes into our building.
Oh, never heard such a thing. Even though while he was president, they had to move him out of Georgia. Not the state of Georgia, but the country of Georgia.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that.
They had to move him out of the hotel he was in because it was the intelligence had said Al-Qaeda was going to use a plane to run into his hotel. So when he says, I had never heard of such a thing, kind of a lot.
When you get a general who used to work for the government becoming political, which is, first of all, a miracle, and second of all, running for office to run against you because he's so horrified by how your mismanagement of national security, and what is wrong with the mainstream press? Why doesn't anyone point that out? All these talking heads and pundits sitting at their dumb desks, you know, it's looking all pretty. Why aren't they saying, gee, a national security advisor general doesn't think you do a good job? A whole pile of colonels and generals when you invaded Iraq said, oh, by the way, you suck. You don't have a plan to get us out of there. There's no end run. There's no end result. You're going to get what you get when you get in there. And even John Stewart, who isn't supposed to be a newsman, ran the clip of Dick Cheney back in HW's days saying, you can't win a war of invasion of Iraq.
I play it all the time.
Oh.
He said, look, you know, you break it, basically the Cheney rule. You break it, you bought it. We kind of brought it.
Yeah, but and you can't win it. You can't put it back together
again.
Because
no one else would be with us, and Cheney knew that back then. But this, you know, it doesn't surprise me that Iraq wasn't really mentioned in the museum. I didn't see anything of any significance.
There were the pictures of the women voting. There were the pictures of the freedom he gave to freedom. A quarter of a million or more Iraqis dead. Freedom. A country that still doesn't have air conditioning and electricity the vast majority of the time. Freedom. He destroyed their infrastructure. That's the Tigris and the Euphrates. That's where the cradle of humanity. That's where human beings began. And they looted and destroyed the archaeological sites.
Well, take away their history.
Oh, yeah. Why isn't that stuff in the museum? Here's an empty box.
They took down, they showed the photograph of Saddam falling and the statue coming down.
See?
That was there.
He did talk about Iraq.
No tubes. When we come back, I want to talk about something else I saw. The new state-of-the-art surveillance techniques and keeping us safe again. It's interesting to me, you know, with all this stuff going on with Obama, that they would highlight this in the Bush Propaganda Center. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. On the Road, the People's Tour for America. Right back.
Right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Rick Smith, and I'd like to invite you to tune in here each and every night through the remainder of 2013 for encore performances of our People's Tour for America.
And I'm Pat LaMarche. I traveled with Rick and his family this past summer on the People's Tour, and we met some pretty amazing folks. So from now until 2014, you'll be able to hear those folks tell their story of how the middle class grew in their part of America. Join us right here weeknights from 9 till midnight.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're on the road, the People's Tour for America. You can follow us on the road, where we've been, where we're going. Just check out the website, thepeoplestourforamerica.com. We're talking about the Bush Museum at SMU, Southern Methodist University, in Dallas, Texas, where we just visited. And, you know, Pat, one of the things that really, I got to be honest, I was choked up for a couple of minutes, but not choked up, I'm just angry. I mean,
did
choked
throw
up
in your mouth or something?
Yeah, I mean, just viscerally angry as I looked at the twisted metal, and I took my 11-year-old daughter through the area where they showed us what happened on 9/11, and I remember that day like it was yesterday. I was in Cleveland. My grandmother was having surgery that day. She was having her knee replaced, and I remember being in the hospital at Cleveland Clinic, where doctors were walking down the hall asking each other, did you do that? And a couple of doctors at the Cleveland Clinic actually got fired out of this, but they were joking to each other, did you do that? And I looked at the display. Yeah, I mean, we had some Arab doctors who were there, you know, joking with the high fives and the whole nine yards. I actually saw that firsthand. So I remember being viscerally angry. But I also remember leaving that building being charged $9 a gallon at the gas station on the way home. And I remember thinking, this is going to be the end of civil liberties as we know it. This is going to be the end of our freedom.
Well, you were clairvoyant on that.
To take that word back. And, you know, this is war. We're going to be mired in this. This is a horrible situation because this guy, the guy that didn't get elected, I believed he was going to do exactly what he did. And as I went through the timeline at the museum or the propaganda center, You know, I just felt angry. You know, I looked at the wall with all the names of the victims, and I go, you know, how dare you exploit these people
further?
Again?
Yeah.
And more. I mean, the bullhorn, like you said earlier, you know, he took that bullhorn and said, this is going in my library, with the forethought of thinking how he's going to frame that. I don't know about you, because you've seen the video so many times of the planes hitting the towers. You know, I stood there with my daughter, and I'm going, you know, is this something I want her to see? And is this the place for it? I'm conflicted.
I think it is important for your daughter to know something that I think the vast majority of the American people have forgotten, and that's that people can seem very nice and be very bad, and that private agendas can overcome the needs of the many. I feel like I'm Spock on Star Trek, you know. But, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, and it's not just a Star Trek line, it's the truth. And in the case of the United States now, the needs of the few have outweighed the needs of the many. They have their high-powered, high-priced, I mean, you don't buy a George Bush cheaply. You don't buy a Barack Obama cheaply, and he sure seems to be getting purchased lately. And it's important for the average American at 11, like your beautiful Sam, or at 80, to remember that things can happen, and they can be done by someone who you otherwise like. I mean, you can't tell me George Bush isn't, like, likable to a lot of people.
I think he's likable.
But he's done this country a great disservice, and he was a bad president, and I think at the end of the day he's a bad man. And even if that's only because he's bad out of selfishness, and only selfish, I think, probably shouldn't be two words that put together, because selfish is bad. I mean, and bad and good are subjective terms, but I really think that being able to work the advantage, game the system to yourself forever, and not care who you hurt. You know, I know all of this stuff about religion, too, about this all being about religion. It's not about religion. It's not about religion when someone flies a plane into your building. It's about being a psychopath. And it's not about religion when you turn your back on the poor or you embrace the poor. It's about humanity. And all of these people hide behind religion for their excuses and reasons for things, but that doesn't hold water. And I feel really sad that Sam had to see it, but I think it's really important that she knows that, you know? I think it's important that she knows that someone who seems nice to her at a party when she's 19 has the potential to harm her if she's not careful. Just because they look nice doesn't mean they are nice.
Yeah. But, you know, as I went through the timeline and we're looking at all the photos of the woman with the ink on her finger, I'm thinking, you know, while we're doing that in Iraq, or saying we are, you know, here we're trying to take people's rights away to vote, and
yeah,
while we're trying to liberate, and you didn't see anything about Operation Iraqi Liberation, did you?
Yeah, oil.
None of that there.
Yeah.
But as I'm looking at the photos and the timelines, there was a display there. You know, and I got to give this place credit. A lot of very interactive stuff. I thought short attention span theater. There wasn't a lot of depth. A lot of flashing images and things like that. But as I looked at this one screen of in the 9/11 terror section, it said, you know, with the use of new surveillance techniques and advanced state-of-the-art surveillance, we thwarted these terrorist attacks. And they gave three examples of which you go, well, those are questionable at best. But here, three
examples when...
Three in 9 years, in the 8-year period, and you go, well, hold on.
And we're driving through a country where more than 10,000 people will be killed in the cities of this country and in the suburbs of this country, and they'll be murdered by their husbands, and they'll be murdered by gangs, and they'll die in this country because of violence that isn't thwarted, that that money isn't thrown at, that nobody is trying to give kids an option other than, you know, getting in a gang for protection or for drugs or for money, you know, and education isn't being invested in, and other options are all some people have, and all of the money that's being thrown at this war on terror is money that could be so much better spent here at home, educating, feeding, protecting, providing for the people of the United States.
Rebuilding, you know, all of that. But, you know, for me, as I was looking at this, as I looked through the museum or the propaganda center, I think that was really the only thing that was you could attribute to the Patriot Act, which, you know, I put on Bush's shoulders.
And Congress
as well.
You throw a whole pile of people in there, like Hillary Clinton, who voted for it. I mean, really, everybody went psychotic after 9/11.
And I remember going to a panel that the League of Women Voters in Allentown had. And they had six people, you know, three people who were for, three people who were against it on this panel. Three people who had read it, three people who had not. Who do you think were the people who were for it?
Well, that's pretty easy.
I don't think you need to answer that. Yeah. But the people who read it were dead set against it. These were law professors who said this is the ending of our civil liberties.
Yeah.
And you know, you look now where with all of this stuff with the NSA, and look at all of this, you know, the listening in and all of the stuff that Obama's now being hit with, and rightly so. These are just carryovers of the Bush policy that he continued.
And nobody minds giving all these Republicans who defended Bush's need for that kind of power are all screaming bloody murder because Obama's got it. You know, and President Obama's using what George Bush gave him to use, and the Congress. And Congress also gave the president the power to wage war. Congress has done nothing but give up their job. The only reason we have sequestration right now is because Congress was too lazy to work on a budget, so they picked a couple of people to work on the budget, and if what they planned didn't work out, mandatory cuts were going to go into place because Congress isn't doing its job. We may as well shut the institution down or fire everybody but Bernie Sanders, as far as I'm concerned, and a couple of others. But, I mean, the United States Congress is supposed to be defending us from a bad president. Your daughter played right at the George Bush Library. She played the Balance of Powers Act game.
Yeah, the Balance of Power game.
It's a board game now. Yeah, and she was good at it. She realized that all the branches have to have equal power or the little topsy-turvy thing falls over. And all of the branches just have been crowded into the president's pocket for the last two administrations at least. And so the balance of powers isn't working anymore. I have to tell you, though, it was really hard to figure out what was upsetting me the most. And I've decided to call it the nauseum. Like nauseated?
That's a good one.
Instead of museum, it's the nauseum. And the thing that upset me the most at George Bush's nauseum was the stuff about Katrina. Oh, for the love of God. You would think that he had handled that well. You would think that 1,000 people didn't drown. You would think that there was appropriate response. You would think there was no, Brownie's doing a good job.
Yeah, why wasn't that quote there? Why was that on the wall?
Why didn't anyone mention that the head of women's health was a veterinarian under the Bush administration? If you wonder what they think of you women, that's the whole story right there. The stuff about Katrina, the pictures of people, you know, paddling in boats, it was just beyond me. The shifting of blame, the shirking of responsibility, his mother, who should have kept her mouth shut and shouldn't have had children, he should just have, instead of allowing the Osama bin Laden family to fly out after 9/11, the only plane allowed to take off in the whole country, giving the public enemy number one back the only leverage we had, instead of them flying out, he should have flown his own family out. Just get Barbara out of here before she insults one more poor person whose life has been destroyed. I mean, the way he handled Katrina looked like he was a knight who went down there, swam to every household, and rescued every person himself.
Rewriting the history.
There isn't possible if you have a close to standard IQ for you to walk into that building and not be disgusted.
But you, the way I looked at it, as I, after I got over the anger and I started walking around and I started looking at, you know, in 30 years, because look, he's only been out of office one term. And I, as I was looking at things, I couldn't believe how much I had forgotten. You know, as I
walked... That's because half of it's not true. No, you can't forget something that didn't happen.
No, as I looked at what he was saying, I'm going, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That wasn't how it happened.
Yeah.
But that's going to be there in 20, 30, 50, 100 years. That's what my grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to learn. That's the history. That's what our history is going to be. And I think looking at it right now through the lens that we have, I think is extremely important, because the way we are seeing this now is not going to be the way the next generation is going to see it. They're going to go, wow,
that's right.
He did a lot.
That's right. Well, you know what? The kids in China don't learn about Tiananmen Square either.
He was the savior.
If we think that history is written by the winners, and the kids in China don't know that the Chinese government ran over living human beings with tanks in Tiananmen Square, they don't get taught that. And if we want to be like China, as far as propaganda goes, welcome. Welcome to the United States of America.
I think this tour, I think us on the road going through a place like Blair, West Virginia, is testament that, you know, in the past we've done that. We've shot, I mean, Latimer, you know, you go just up the road up near Hazleton, where 19 workers were shot in the back, peacefully marching from Allentown to Scranton. Nobody went to jail. Nobody was convicted. Nobody.
And nobody's going to get convicted in West.
Which is another place we went on this tour. And, you know, but here again, I mean, you go back to the Bush Library and you look at all of the policies that this guy put into place, all of the directions he took this country, I can't think of much that you would give him actual credit for. And I guess, you know, it's easy to then say, wow, you just didn't like him. It was his policy, really, I despised.
I also really resented the number of pictures in that nauseam of double amputees playing golf and stuff.
Him pushing the guy on the bike up a hill.
Yeah. I mean, here's this able-bodied man who didn't have anything ever injure him in his life because he was protected by his father, his very powerful father, his grandfather, Prescott Bush, who stole Geronimo's head as a prank, stole the skull when he was in Skull and Bones Society in Yale. Here's this C-minus Yale graduate who his father gave $1 million to Harvard so he could get an MBA, and he's just, you know, he's a loser, and he's around these wounded warriors, these guys with no legs, and they're exploiting these men and trying to make it look like they lost their legs for a reason, which is so tragic to me, so awful. And I value those men so much. I value the women. I value the service that they are willing to perform. And I find any politician who puts them in harm's way for no reason to be public enemy number one. And the pictures he had of himself with those people, it was disgusting.
More
was photo repulsive.
Ops. And I guess, you know, one of the other things I take from our trip to the museum was his willingness to use so many for photo ops.
Yeah. Well, he had to keep the myth going. He had to keep the fear going so he could keep stealing people's privacy. He had to keep the myth going that we needed a savior so he could be it. And what I have learned from this trip, probably the thing I've learned the most in our 8 or 9 days, is that when he stood on the bridge of that ship and said, mission accomplished, he didn't mean the war. He meant war without end. He meant Halliburton's no-bid contracts. He meant the complete and total mortgaging of our grandchildren to pay for the excesses of his career. He meant mission accomplished. I have screwed the American people and made them love me for it. That was the mission he accomplished.
So did you like entrepreneurial Bush with his Texas Ranger boots and all of that?
Oh, wasn't that funny? You know, talk about rewriting history. He's like, oh, I'm a business owner. You drove the business into the ground.
And it was basically given to him. My kid needs a job. Here, let's.
It's like, yeah, it's like when someone gives me a plant. In 6 weeks, it will be dead. You know? Don't give me a flower that needs water. You know, he took a business that was vibrant and killed it. And he's a millionaire.
Entrepreneurial Bush.
That was a trip.
I mean, but there was so much of it that you just. I think we're going to be talking about the Bush Propaganda Center for months to come. Because there was so much. He was the savior of Social Security. He saved Social Security. I couldn't believe, and I really couldn't believe, that he would put the Medicare Part D plan in there as a great accomplishment. The fact that we're the only country in the world that does not negotiate for drug prices, that's an accomplishment.
That arrests old ladies for going into Canada to buy some medicine. And that was all a giveaway to the drug companies. But, you know, I remember every morning after the 2005, the early part of 2005, when I just finished running for vice president. I'm trying to put my life back together. We recounted Ohio, so that was really busy. So it's like springtime, April. I remember it vividly. There was a woman in Florida that they wanted to unplug. The husband wanted to unplug her, and the parents didn't. And that was this huge topic. And ongoing, what was her name? Do you remember that?
Terry Schiavo.
Terry Schiavo. My God, you have a fabulous memory. Anyway.
Well, Rick Santorum was down for an Outback Steakhouse fundraiser down in Tampa there. And he put himself right and interjected himself right into the middle of that.
So the Terry Schiavo thing is going on at the same time that Bush is trying to dismantle Social Security. And those are the two big news stories. And I'm trying to get my career back on track because, Lord knows, don't run for vice president. It will mess you up. Also, don't hunt with one. But so I'm trying to put my career back together. And these are the two big news stories. And story after story after story is him trying to dismantle Social Security, traveled the country trying to talk
with
the country into
cabinet.
It. Yeah, and he wrote in his own memoir that obviously the people from the nauseam didn't read. He wrote in his own memoir, which he probably didn't write, my biggest mistake of my administration was allowing Paul Ryan to talk me into trying to dismantle Social Security. That was what he put in his memoir. Now, what we didn't know was it was going to be hopefully the biggest mistake of the Obama career was trying to dismantle Social Security. But he actually said in his memoir he shouldn't have done it. But in his nauseam, it says he saved Social Security?
Yeah, but not...
How, by being ineffective?
Yeah, let me back up a little bit on that. Because not because he cares about Social Security, but because he got his butt kicked doing it.
Yeah.
It was because he used up a bunch of what he called political capital, and it blew up in his face. You know, I remember that tour that you spoke of with the filing cabinet, him and his... You know, I seen him. You know, there's filing cabinets. But I'll use... Not that those IOUs are backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government. No. They're just worthless pieces of paper. They just got paper down there. And we just can't do it.
It's not even true.
I know. But, you know, you need imagery. The simplistic. And to me, the...
Because you must stand for something if you're going to stand for office.
There you go. And the last thing I want to talk about the Bush Museum, because I got to move on to West.
Yeah.
The interactives. The Decider Theater.
You mean the electronic alibi?
Did you make it through?
I couldn't.
The Decider?
No.
I sat and I went through one of them and very, very black and white. Very cut and dry.
So what happened was there was a theater and you could go in it and they would give you the opportunity to hear two sides of the problem.
You're the Decider.
And then you made the decision based on the two sides of the problem. And that's what it's like to be a president. It's not my fault. I had to listen to a lot of people. And then I had to make a choice. I had all these people telling me things that they all said different things.
A lot of words.
Words, yeah.
Lots of words.
Oh, my God. And then I had to decide.
Lots of reading and writing. Some arithmetic.
I couldn't believe the hubris. And then you got little children there. Okay, so if a general tells you this, and then one of your other advisors says don't do it, God, what are you gonna do?
And I love that they had, you know, you could get people from the Senate, people from the House of Representatives, people from Wall Street on the Wall Street crisis, and they actually had a spokesperson for the taxpayers. And I was going, wow, they picked one person in the suburbs, and that's who you're going to. Okay, good. But you know, but
it was Grover Norquist, by the way.
But to me, you know, I look at this, and it really, it really signifies what his administration was. If you just step back for a second and go, look, he was a guy who was very black or white. There was no nuance. There was no, it was right or left. It was right or wrong. It was black or white. There was either we bail him out completely or we do nothing and let everything fail and go straight to Hades. There was no talk of policy forward. There was no talk of historical context and all of the bad decisions that led up to it and all of the things that he didn't do in the years that led up to it. It was meant to get people to sympathize with him more than anything.
Yeah, it was to let him off.
To go, boy, this is a hard job. And they kept breaking news coming in with phony news clips and all kind of stimulus. To where you got to hurry and it's timed. You got to do it. You got to come up with a decision before the end of the minute and a half or whatever it was, which just made me. I just had to chuckle. And at the end, when the number of people in the room made their decision, of which I did the financial crisis. Everyone decided basically let the banks fail. He out steps Bush, goes, well, you know, I decided. I made the decision to help the banks because you know what? They'd have collapsed like. And then nothing had happened. And again, like you said, the alibi.
It's yeah, and you know what? The real reason he decided to help the banks is, well, I'm going to help the banks because they're going to blame the guy who comes after me for doing that.
I got to be honest with you, though, Pat. You know, for the year and a half before the collapse happened, I was screaming on air. March of 2009, the collapse is coming. They're doing everything they can do to prop this failing economy up. We're doing all of the wrong things. And it didn't take a genius or a clairvoyant to figure it out. What surprised me is that it happened in September of 2008. That it was even worse than I had imagined because they couldn't keep it propped up and quiet long enough to put it off on the next guy.
You know what surprises me? That you even think people would be forward thinking when they won't pay attention to what's happening today. I mean, that's part of the beauty of the Rick Smith Show is if people come and listen, they can hear your understanding, rapid understanding of things. But really, the biggest problem is the average person right now is so overwhelmed, they don't get what's happening today. They don't, I mean, except for somebody who's making fun of it. You know, I mean, I love Jon Stewart. I'm not putting him down, but really, that's what he's doing. He's making fun of it. Or like the things you get on the internet with pictures of President Obama listening on your conversation. It's a joke. It's a joke. It's a joke. Well, it's not a joke. It's really happening. And do yourself a favor and go watch 10 YouTubes of George Carlin. Because it's really happening.
Yep.
And so, I mean, we've got to get people to say, this is my world. And then we also have to get people to say, 10 million people took to the streets of the United States of America and said, no war in Iraq, and they were ignored. How are we going to get, we got to get 20 million people in the streets next time then, I guess. Or 50 million, but we got to do it.
I'm right there with you. It comes, it's doing that grassroots organizing, neighbor to neighbor, coworker to coworker. It's from the bottom up, and not a well-funded Tea Party thing, an actual people's movement.
Vote with your dollars. Stay the heck out of every business that supports this garbage, and start with a damn.
Start with the wall.
Right. Start there, but start with the Gates Foundation. You know. Go to a used computer store to buy your next computer, unless you buy, you know, some other product. Do not give Bill Gates one more dime. His big fat name up there, a pox on him too.
We've got to get that list, and we're going to continue to work on it to where we get. And I want to know how much it costs to get on that wall. How much to chisel a name in the wall? And can we get our name on there, you know, after the fact?
We should have brought a marker, a little Sharpie. Can you imagine how fast your hands would be chopped off?
Wow, Guantanamo, here we go. I'm sure they've got Guantanamo recreated in the basement just for that type of thing. We're going to take a quick break right back from the road, the People's Tour for America, right back after this.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart.
the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
We're dark in the midnight sky. We feel the fire burning in the belly. The flame leaps out with an angry cry. From the
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Lost. They are with the Lord now. Our task here on earth is to save lives from being lost in another such tragedy. To do what we must do individually and collectively to assure safe conditions underground. To treat our miners like they treat each other, like a family. Because we are all family and we are all Americans.
I think it's time for change.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Or you can go to PeoplesTourForAmerica.com, see where we've been, where we're going. You know, after we left the Bush White House, off the Bush propaganda house there, down to west, about an hour and a half south of Dallas, where on April 18th, a massive explosion. And, you know, I showed my daughter the video that a guy took of his son. Him and his son were watching the fire from a distance. And the explosion, the massive explosion that, you know, basically just ripped through this area, creating a 93-foot crater 10 feet deep that we went and we visited after we went to the Bush Propaganda Center. And, Pat, have you ever seen an area like that?
Well, I was at the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, so I saw some pretty devastating disaster, you know, reality. I think the thing that was startling to me more than the disaster was the foolish nature of the whole thing. You know, and obviously that's the case too for the levee, but building a fertilizer plant that makes the stuff that Timothy McVeigh used to blow up the building in Oklahoma City, putting that building less than 500 feet from a school, you know?
And a nursing home 1,000 feet from that place.
And that was amazing. You could just see each little cubicle that had been an elderly person's home, and you could see the couches in there, you could see the beds.
All still there, 2 months later.
All still there, yeah. Shattered. The building is shattered. The roof has completely been blown to smithereens. Parts of it were completely caved in. The parts of the building look like an earthquake happened instead of an explosion. Just broken apart. And then every single house for several blocks, the facing side to the explosion, just shattered. It was amazing, and all I could think of was the devastation we wreak in other countries with our explosives. We are now wreaking it here, and you call it what is it?
Disaster capitalism.
Disaster capitalism. Yeah, it's war. It's a war game. It's a war game when capitalism kills people at the Big Branch mine that President Obama said, you know, we have to cut this out and care about human life. And it's war when people blow up the workplace, and it's located. Now, I don't know, who's the big owner of the factory of the fertilizer factory. Do we know who's the
parent company? I don't
remember
his name.
Does he live in town?
Yeah, I mean, a beloved person in the town.
Did his kids go to that school?
I can only imagine that they may have. But here again, when I look at this, here's a guy who, the last time OSHA inspected that plant was 1985.
Shame on you, OSHA.
And, you go back, and for me, it's all of this talk about deregulation. It's all of the Michelle Bachmann saying, they're the job-killing, EPA's the job-killing organization of America, and all of these regulatory bodies are killing jobs and killing profits. Well, what about the people that they're killing? All this deregulation. This is the disease of deregulation.
But they're not killing profits. I'll tell you what's killing profits. Blowing up your town.
But
that's not going to make him wealthy.
But he's not going to be the one paying for it either. And as my daughter and I were walking around, standing in front of the school, I could only think of, what if it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon and that school was full of children? How many more deaths would we have? How many more injuries?
Hundreds.
But, she said to me, she goes, the person who did this, they should have to clean it all up. They should have to clean it all up, and they should have to pay to make everybody whole. And I said, that's just not going to happen.
Sam for president.
I absolutely agree, and I will be her campaign manager and happily to vote for her. But, we think that way. I think as a nation we think, okay, the guy, he's going to have to pay to fix this. He's going to have to be the guy who cleans up the mess.
But he can't sell fertilizer that just blew up. He can't be making money. This isn't a cost savings. It doesn't make money for him. So saying I saved money by not having an OSHA inspection and I saved money by not being regulated, that's just blatantly not true. And my favorite part of the tragedy, if that's a possible sentence to articulate, is the fact that the deregulated plant hadn't been checked on by anybody since the Reagan administration, blew up a school and a senior center on Reagan Street. Now, there must be a God if that's not a message we can all pay attention to. God wants you to inspect these plants. And she's not happy.
Yeah, not happy at all. But, you said a second ago that it's not profitable to cut corners. And I think on the very short term, American business has learned the lesson that you know what? Short term, it is profitable, and it's extremely profitable to externalize the negative costs. Sure, this guy's going to, for now, is going to lose just about everything business wise. Personally, I think he'll be fine.
Yeah, it's probably an LLC.
Absolutely. I mean, there's all the ways of putting barriers up to where we never really go after the people. In Bangladesh, that factory that collapsed, they're going to put that guy in jail, and they'll probably end up executing him. You execute one CEO in country for something like that, I guarantee it stops.
Might take three. You put
there's
him
a
in,
line.
You remember the Enron thing? What, like one fall guy takes it and he's the guy that's dead anyway in a couple of months of a terminal illness.
Yep.
It's like we were in Dallas. It's like
he's the Jack Ruby.
The Jack Ruby. We got the Jack Ruby CEOs, but taking the hit on this stuff. I feel as though there is no personal accountability for any of this stuff. And if people really want corporations to be people, then the people that run the corporations, if they're going to have that much power, have to have that much responsibility. And they need to be held accountable. And every single person whose home was destroyed. Actually, Sam is right here. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
Tell us what you thought about those houses. You saw those houses. Totally devastated. What were your feelings?
I was sad because they all lost their homes because someone didn't bother to take care of the plants.
How frightened do you think? Were you frightened just being there after the fact?
Kind of, because I felt like them being at home and then the explosion. Whenever I watched the video with my dad, it just frightened me because the sun couldn't hear, and just the way that it went off, it scared me.
Yeah, the sun couldn't hear. And that's the thing about sound, is sound has a lot of sound waves, like ask a dog. There are a lot of sounds you can't hear. And when that explosion happened, the kid couldn't hear anymore because all those other waves that were packed with the sound that was audible to the camera had damage that kid's hearing, who knows for how long, but certainly in the short run, he couldn't hear a thing.
But he was several hundred feet away from that. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine the explosion, 93-foot crater, 10-foot deep? Could you imagine the power and the force?
And one of the things I think that was probably saddest, but we were... And, you know, we're going to take a long time to process all the things we've seen. But one of the things that was so sad was we went to the fire department. And, you know, there's all the solidarity, all the different fire departments that went down there to help. They all there's, you know, the patch from New York City and the shirt from Seattle and all these different fire departments that were there. But there's a big picture of seven brave, courageous men, first responders, who are no more, who are gone, who are dead, because there was a fire, they responded to it.
And they didn't know what they were getting into.
No.
And they had assumed that this company was following the law, they had assumed that they were within regulation, and nobody told them that this bomb of a magnitude multiple of what Timothy McVeigh used to blow up the Murrah building in Oklahoma City was right there in front of them.
And it blew them up and killed them. And the fire department had a thing to them. And kids in the area, it looks like someone had an art therapist in the town. And they had kids make these little stars that were all over the place. You can see these pictures on the website. See pictures of the Bush Library. You can see the pictures of everything we've done. You go to thericksmithshow.com. Go to People's Tour for America. Go to the Facebook pages. You can see the pictures of these things. But honest to goodness, I mean, except for that, and the decorations and the literal decorations, meaning the tribute to these fallen firefighters, there's nothing in that town that says it happened. Nothing but the giant scar. Not even FEMA. I mean, no federal...
Emergency management money coming in there.
And, no
and they just decided, no money. And look, I got to
no
be honest with you, Pat.
No federal equipment. I didn't see any cars or trucks or nothing.
No.
Nothing.
But here's the thing, and this is one of those things that, you know, is that what FEMA is for? For me, when I look at this and when I read the story, and it's easy to make FEMA the bad guy in this. This wasn't a natural disaster. This wasn't a hurricane or a tornado. This was a man-made disaster that was completely preventable.
Well, you know, they got to take the word emergency out of it if it's not what it's for. It's the Federal Emergency Management Administration or whatever. If their name has emergency in it, I don't care what caused the emergency. If it turns out that this guy needs to be absolutely sued right down to his toenails by the federal government and every pound penny paid back to FEMA, then so be it. But in the meantime, the people of West Texas should not be waiting on a thing. FEMA should be down there. FEMA should be helping. And I didn't even see Red Cross. I didn't see anybody.
No.
I saw nothing. A Baptist church.
There were a handful of people who were working. There were a handful of people who were trying to do the cleanup. But here, 2 months after the fact, you still see buildings blown apart. You still see the way it looked probably the day the fire was put out. And, you know, as someone who has kids, as someone who has a family, and I look at that disaster and, man, I wish that on no one, and I wish that scenario on no one, which is why I'm a firm believer in sane, rational regulation and oversight. Just is what it is. But again, if you want to see pictures of West, what we have seen, go to the website, thericksmithshow.com, or People's Tour for America. Quick break. We're going to pick it up on the other side of the hour. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Oh, I'm going to work. Could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the worker.
War on the worker.
Oh, it's a war on the worker.
War on the worker.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The battles for higher wages and union rights being waged around the country by fast food workers, retail workers, Walmart warehouse workers, and port workers is part of a dynamic new low-wage worker movement in America. From New York City to St. Louis, from Milwaukee to Chicago to Detroit, and to L.A. and beyond, workers assisted by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW are standing up for higher wages and the right to form unions. Martine Raffanon is with the St. Louis Workers Organizing Committee in the St. Louis Can't Survive on 735 campaign.
There are 36,000 fast food jobs in St. Louis. That's one part of the low-wage worker spectrum. We've got home care workers. We've got workers in retail. These workers need to change the context of these jobs, make them strong middle-class jobs. That's our work. That's our goal. This movement resonates so broadly across our community in terms of both workers and those who stand with workers in St. Louis and then across the nation. These workers are leading the charge, but this is a fight for all of us. There's a coalition of unions that are working to support this effort in Missouri, in St. Louis, and also we have a tremendous infrastructure for support of these workers through Missouri Jobs with Justice.
For the second time this month, Turkish labor unions have called a general strike to protest the harsh police actions against protesters in Istanbul's Taksim Square. Five trade union confederations began a one-day nationwide strike Monday, and are also calling on workers to take to the streets to protest government actions. During the last general strike in the first week of June, this unidentified Turkish protester told Canada's Radio Labor that economic injustice for workers, as Turkey's economy expands, is helping drive these protests.
So this is sort of like a 99% issue. The growth of the economy is creating more inequality in earnings and is therefore antagonizing the people.
Construction has come to a halt in the Canadian province of Quebec. Jesse Russell reports.
With contract negotiations between the Construction Association and unions who represent the workers falling apart this weekend, the construction workers walked off the job Monday morning. The strike impacts business, residential, industrial, and municipal construction. The association is seeking more authority when it comes to requiring employees to work on Saturdays, and they also want to create a 14-hour workday. Employers are also seeking to pay less for overtime. Currently, workers receive double time, but the employers want to only pay time and a half. More than 175,000 and construction workers are walking the picket lines. Both sides have accused the other of bargaining in bad faith. This is the first construction strike in the province in 30 years.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor is union-owned, union-represented, and the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. The People's Tour for America on the road. Coming to a city near you, you can check out the website and find out where we've been, where we're going, what we've seen, what we've done. And you can also be in contact with the program. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, all the ways to reach out to the program. And also see the pictures, the devastation that was West Texas. Pat, you know, in looking at the photos and looking at, you know, standing on those on the streets, one of the things that caught my attention, and really just the magnitude of this explosion, and I pointed it out to my daughter, who loves playing basketball, the basketball poles.
Yeah.
Did you see the posts?
Yeah.
Both of them blown at almost a 45-degree angle, still anchored in the ground, the hoop gone, the backboard gone, but the pole completely blown over.
Yeah, and also the lights for the basketball courts blown off their bases, but the wiring still connected. It was it had to be just so horrible. And looking at the pictures of the seven firefighters that died, thinking of their moms. I'm a mom. A lot of those firefighters were about my son's age, 25, you know, that they looked that young anyway. I mean, how do you send your son to work and then have a disaster happen in your community and then find out that your son, who was doing a service to his community and to the people around him in such a loving fashion, you know, was blown to bits because nobody cared to keep the place safe. It wasn't because he was lowered out of a helicopter to save a baby from the, you know, from the jaws of an alligator. He just walked up to a fire he was trying to put out, but because nobody kept the place safe, somebody killed your son. How do you go to sleep the next 200 nights?
Nothing personal, just business. And, you know, as I've said for the past couple of days, you know, if I wanted to kill somebody, I would just hire him. And that's the sad failure of our laws.
Because you can get away with it.
Because you can get away with it. And while the guy who owns this company, he may be the greatest guy on the planet. At the end of the day, the actions, the decisions made in that plant, and they're not going to be held accountable for it. I mean, maybe a fine, maybe a slap on the wrist, and yeah, okay, the company doesn't exist now. Then what about the workers? What about the rebuilding? What about all of the other things that go into it? Because this guy was allowed to cut corners? Does that make any sense to you?
And where did the town go? It was like being in an episode of The Twilight Zone. There were a couple of guys on bulldozers bulldozing down what was left of houses and stuff. There were a couple of people picking through the rubble to get out whatever. Maybe they were getting their own things. There was a woman in a bakery. Oh, and other than that, there was nobody. It was like we were going to go to Roswell on the next stop, but the aliens came and took the town after they blew it to smithereens. It was like, where was the community? The place was deserted. It was so bizarre.
It was very eerie.
Yeah, it was like the creepiest experience. Where was the lunch wagon that should have been going around to the neighborhood helping to feed people? Where was the Red Cross? Were they there? Where did the people go? We saw dozens, if not scores, of houses that were unlivable. Where are the people? Where are the people?
Well, one would hope is that they're being put up in hotels somewhere outside of town, because maybe the town doesn't have the capabilities. Who knows? At this point, I hope that they're well. I hope that they're on their way back to rebuilding.
Sure didn't look it.
You know, I go back and I think about, you know, when the house I owned burned, and I remember at the time. It was difficult. I mean, my wife and I lived in a hotel for about 2 months, and you know, the whole process of going through the insurance company and all that was difficult. I can't imagine this, where those houses just gone. I mean, it was weird.
Where are the old people from the old folks' home?
A lot of questions that we couldn't get answers to.
We couldn't even find anybody. It was so strange.
And I saw no media there. You didn't see it. The school looked probably the same as it did the day it happened. They just put a big fence around it.
And put the fire out. But you could see where the flames were licking the sides of the school. I mean, you've got to see these pictures. Go to thericksmithshow.com. Go to thepeoplestoreforamerica.com. Go to the Facebook pages. You've got to see these pictures. They are horrifying. And my dad was the chief of medicine at a hospital in Maine. And one day, a train was going by the hospital. It ran right close to the hospital. And he called the train company and he said, what are you traveling by the hospital with? And they said, what do you mean? And he said, well, what's on the train cars? And they said, well, what do you need to know that for? And he said, because I've got a hospital full of people here. What's in the tanks that go by the hospital? And they hemmed and hawed before he could get the information, but they were transporting tanks of chlorine gas. Well, liquid chlorine, so if one of them had ruptured, it would have become chlorine gas. So my father said, not anymore, you're not. You know, I don't think you realize this, but that was your last train that's going by my hospital with chlorine gas until we work out a plan. And I'll tell you what, nobody was happy with my father, you know.
Except for the people who didn't get killed if something would have happened.
Right. But those sorts of forward thinkingness, you know, whatever, farsightedness.
Planning?
Yeah.
Thoughtful planning?
I mean, and fault or not to the railroad company, maybe they don't think about that. Maybe whomever doesn't think about that. But there was a railroad running next to a hospital. And that's all I could think of. All I could think of was my father pitching that fit and making everybody angry. But there was a fertilizer plant next to an elementary school. And that's the end of the conversation from the way I look at it.
And who made the decision to allow that to be built there? You know, who said this is a good, and looking at where we were,
yeah.
I mean, really, you're talking about Texas, a huge state with miles and miles and miles. Who decided that it would be a great idea to put an elementary school, a nursing home, and a hospital all within 2,500 feet of a fertilizer plant?
Well, it made sense to me that the fertilizer plant was there because the railroad was there. And I think the fertilizer plant might have pre-existed at least the school, because the school looked pretty new. So, okay, the fertilizer plant needs to be near the railroad, and if you've ever ridden a train, you know it goes through the backyard of every wrong side of the town. Why put the school there? And then again, why not make that fertilizer safe enough so that your kids could go visit their parents every day at work if they wanted to? The fertilizer plant should have been so safe that a firefighter could have gone to work that day and gone home again.
Well, had they followed the law, I understand that it would have been. They had something hundreds of times more the legal limit than they were, the reportable legal limit that they were allowed to have in their storage. They weren't supposed to have all of the ammonium nitrate that they have.
It's just, I'm rocking my head, which doesn't work well on radio.
I mean, this whole thing, I mean, all of this stuff, it just leaves you kind of just shaking your head going, what are we thinking, or are we thinking?
And so we go to this bakery that we've been recommended should go to.
We were told it is the bakery that put West on the map.
Before it got blown off the map.
Before the fertilizer plant blew it off.
Right. And this was the thing, reason people went to West. It was Czechoslovakian bakery. And everything we heard about it was true, plus maybe a little bit yummier. And we walk in, and there's this sweet young woman working behind the counter.
Who I couldn't believe worked at a donut place. Probably one of the skinniest human beings I've ever seen.
Maybe she has a tapeworm. We could hope.
Had to be. Working behind the counter with all of that there.
Sorry, darling. How long has it been you've had the tapeworm? You should have asked her.
I have.
But, so she's, I mean, and they're selling cozies. I've never seen this done for a disaster relief in my life. I thought for sure it was going to be a wristband or something. Buy a wristband that says, you know, and it said, pray for West. But it wasn't. It was a cozy. And if you don't know what a cozy is, you've never had a Budweiser. But it was a little thing you put on your beer bottle so it doesn't sweat all over your hand and it stays a little colder as you...
And it hides the label.
Is that the other reason?
No, that's the reason.
Oh, I didn't know that. No, it's not to keep it cold. It's not an insulator from your 98.6 hand and your 32-degree beer?
No.
Oh. Anyway, so...
That's the sales portion of it, but the reason you get one of those is that make people think you're drinking soda.
Okay, so they're selling disaster cozies, which I've never seen in my life. And whatever makes it happen, whatever helps these people.
It's the free market.
So I buy a couple of cozies, one pink with lettering that says Pray for West, and the other camo with Pray for West on it. So This woman is working in a town that's been blown up. The disaster is everywhere. There's nothing but silence, like it's a segment out of Alfred Hitchcock. And she's selling me cozies that say pray for West on it, so we all know that something happened. And I'm like, okay, thank you, and I give her the money, and nothing. Not oh, thanks for helping the town. Not, gee, you're not from around here. Not, you know, nothing. It's like, oh, yeah, of course you bought a disaster cozy. That's what people do. And, oh, yeah, no, we don't want to talk about the fact that our town blew up. It was just, wasn't that weird?
It was extremely weird because I didn't want the koozies. I just gave them $20 and said, hey, you know, it's the least I can do. And I got a really bizarre reaction out of, I didn't want the koozies. Sell them, give them to somebody else. Raise a little bit more money that way.
She probably wonders why you don't care that your beer gets warm. Or someone has gone in there and replaced these people. With Stepford. It's Stepford West.
Stepford West. Interesting. Or maybe they've been abducted by aliens.
Which brings us to Roswell. Okay, this is going to be a really tough transition because Roswell was a blast. And I didn't mean to use that word. Roswell was a lot of fun.
Oh.
I didn't mean to use that. I realized this is...
Wrong.
I know. Sorry.
We're going to take a quick break. Hail Marys for you.
I will say them, too.
Quick break after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of your... Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but obviously not Catholic. When I had to do the
I've done
the
a million rosaries, yeah.
When I had to do the penance, it
I'm
was,
sorry.
You know, the quick versions.
You did it fast?
The Hail Mary, full of grace, amen.
Oh, I'll tell you what. You
or as George Carlin said, the really fast ones, like when you're falling off the back of a truck, amen!
Oh, no. First of all, I really believed they'd work, so
yeah.
I said the whole thing.
I never bought it.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to use the bad
I remember
word.
Being pain. I remember the suffering. Because where I went to school, they didn't have pads on the kneelers. They had floor tile.
Oh, my.
So, and here, as a kid growing up, I had Osgood Slaughters on my knees because my bones were growing faster than my body. So the bones were growing outward. So kneeling on these tiles was excruciating. And I think the nuns took great joy in that.
Well, they had a difficult life.
Yeah.
You've got cute legs now.
Yeah,
so it worked out.
Yeah.
A little hairy.
Evil. Sadistic.
Me or the nuns?
In fact, yes. You know, we used to joke when I was a kid that some of them were aliens. And, you know, on our trip to Roswell, I kind of felt the presence of some of those evil, sadistic, repressed...
I gotta tell you something. You have clearly jinxed us with all this nun bashing. That's why we had a tornado warning.
Yeah, well, that was fun, though, wasn't it?
It was a fabulous electrical storm. And so I'm thinking, oh, there's only one other time I remember an electrical storm this bizarre and this all-encompassing. And that's when I was in a tornado storm. So I look it up, and sure enough, tornado warning, northwestern Texas.
Yeah, and as I'm driving, I'm going, I sure hope there's not a tornado coming.
So I lean over and I say, Rick, because I don't want the young people to hear there's a tornado because we don't want mayhem. Rick, there's a tornado warning. So we decide, well, we can't stand still and we can't keep going. We got to do both. So we just charged on and literally got into New Mexico and it stopped.
Yeah, I mean, it was weird. As soon as you got into New Mexico, everything was nice. But, you know, I looked around and I was going, this is not good. The sky doesn't look good. The storm, we pull over, we wait. We get blown over in our cardboard box. Or we keep going and we get blown over.
Right.
Hopefully we get through it. And we did.
Yeah, it's a matter of where the tornado lands and where you are. And that's all one big old crapshoot.
Yeah, I mean, I try not to do dumb things. Like, you know, the guy who chased storms for years. Not surprising he ended up getting killed. I try not to do dumb things like that, but I'm ultimately a fatalist. When it's my time, it's my time. So
I just hope
we forge
your
right
time, on. I'm somewhere else.
No, you'll be in the back screaming.
That old joke, I hope when I die it's
like Grandpa did.
Like Grandpa, not screaming like everyone else in his car.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we headed into Roswell, and I got to be honest, that, you know, as a kid growing up, that was like alien heaven because, you know, you know, back in the 40s, I guess it was 47, the space saucer crashed. And I love the T-shirts that, you know, show a crashed flying saucer, the guy going, it wasn't my fault. I loved that, but, you know, it was cool
was
to be there.
George Bush from the Instant Alibi.
Oh, yeah. There you go. But, you know, I looked at it, and I was glad to see that they embraced it. I mean, everywhere you looked, you saw aliens on the light fixtures, on the street lights, alien heads. I mean, it's kind of like Hershey with the Hershey Kisses.
Or Biglerville with the apples.
There you go.
Pretty cool.
I liked it. I wish we would have had more time to stay. You know, that's the problem with doing these tours. We're in and out of places real quick. We had a really good conversation with the person who takes care of the elevators in Roswell.
I was just going to say, there was an R2-D2 mailbox.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm saying. A little R2-D2 mailbox. Yeah, but there, you know, I never thought of elevator. I don't ever think of elevator builders or elevator repair people. And when you told me there was an elevator to outer space, I got to admit, I was a little skeptical. And then you found this woman.
Yep, and she's the one.
She knows.
She does.
She services it.
Absolutely. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show on the road. The People's Tour for America. Right back.
We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Rick Smith, and I'd like to invite you to tune in here each and every night through the remainder of 2013 for encore performances of our People's Tour for America.
And I'm Pat LaMarche. I traveled with Rick and his family this past summer on the People's Tour, and we met some pretty amazing folks. So from now until 2014, you'll be able to hear those folks tell their story of how the middle class grew in their part of America. Join us right here weeknights from 9 till midnight.
On July 5, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, it should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry. Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Show.com, the People's Tour for America on the road, and we've made it all the way to Roswell, New Mexico. Last night, driving through Texas, weren't sure.
So the kids wanted to know where this elevator is. They wanted to know where the if they could go ride on the elevator, and, well, she can't tell me where it is now.
No. She could tell you, but she'd have to kill you.
Yeah.
Right.
So let's talk about you, LJ, because, you know, I can't imagine that there are an awful lot of women who have access to the alien elevator, let alone to elevator construction as a whole across the country. How'd you get into this?
Well, my journey was very long and arduous. Most people that are in this elevator industry are born into the industry. They come in through their family. I didn't know anybody in the industry, so I was like an outsider trying to come in. And my journey started in San Francisco. And I was shortly, you know, finished my duty in the United States Army. I graduated at the top of my mechanic class. And I landed in the post office looking for mechanic work, with still with the government, though, because that was the only source I knew. And eventually, someone came across an elevator, female elevator mechanic wanted sign over in Oakland, California, when they were building the federal building project of the federal towers. And after a lot of inquiry, trying to find out how to get in, I spent about 5 years of my life waiting for job interviews and the actual opportunity to get to work in the elevator trade.
Wow, that's dedication. Now, you were born and raised here in Roswell, went into the military, and then ended up going to California.
Yes, eventually to California. I was 30 years old when I started seeking elevator work, and I didn't actually get physically in the trade until I was 37. It took me that long.
Wow.
Fighting the stream of discrimination to get into the elevator trade.
And why did you want to get into, why that particular field? Because, I mean, and when we were talking earlier, you said that you have a master's degree and you're extremely well educated.
Yes.
You know, why this one? What is it about the elevator work that draws you?
Well, the tools that I used to work on automobiles were the same tools they used to work on elevators. So I had all the tool familiarity. But I also am not afraid of heights. In fact, I adore heights.
Well, that makes one of us.
Okay.
See, I'm allergic to heights. I shouldn't say that. I'm allergic to gravity.
Okay. I think gravity would love you.
Yeah, but I wouldn't love it. It's like they say, it's not the fall that kills you. It's that thing at the end.
Right. So the lure of working on high-rise construction and working on elevators because of the heights, just drew me. And I had no idea about the building trades when I started trying to get into this business. I had no idea how the trades work interconnectedly among each other. All I knew was that I was a top graduate from the military with two college degrees, physically fit, not afraid of heights, and ready to go into a high-paying, good benefit job.
And something you were qualified for, and something you should have easily been accepted
right.
for.
Right. That's what I thought. And
she didn't have a you-know-what. Let's face it. There's a sexism that's pervasive in the world, and it's, I mean, yeah, the military must have had a certain amount of it, but it was illegal to acknowledge it, right?
Yeah. I could even talk about discrimination in the military, but I guess it pales in comparison to the discrimination I faced in the elevator business. So, like I said, it took me 7 years to get in the door.
Wow.
And after 5 years of, well, that wanted sign that for a female elevator mechanic at those towers they were building in Oakland, federal project where affirmative action was heavily encouraged and enforced, they managed, the elevator company that had that project, managed to put me off for 5 years with all my qualifications, even though they posted a female elevator wanted sign, they were able to put me off until the project completely wrapped up.
Jeez.
So I never set foot on that project.
That's amazing. So tell me, LJ, then what did you do? How did you get past that? I mean, because that to me that would have been one of those moments where you go, this just isn't going to happen.
Right.
I'm going to go do something else.
Right. Well, to say the least, they were discouraging me, stringing me along and discouraging me at the same time. But as God would have it, I ran into key people along the way. One of those was Mary Trammell at the Ella Hill Hutch Community Center there in San Francisco, the Western edition of San Francisco. And she taught me that I could get into the carpentry trade and maybe eventually make a transfer into the elevator trade. The elevator people were aware of this and encouraged this. And after the 5 years of those towers wrapping up, they finally gave me a foot in the door, and they put me on a project that was literally in Ella Hill Hutch's backyard. And they worked me. In the elevator trade, you have to go through a probationary period, 6 months. And the contractor that hired me worked me for, and I have to gain 600 work hours in that 6 months.
Right.
They worked me for 575 hours and laid me off. And basically laughed at me, too. And I went to the elevator union, and I said, look what these guys just did to me. They let me get this close and laid me off. And they go, yeah, well, just keep trying and see if you can get your 25 hours. And before that could happen, those hours expired, and they made me start all over from scratch. Yeah. But the expiration of that time was probably 9 months. So I went 9 months with no work, having left the carpentry trade and trying to go into the elevator trade. So 9 months later, I got my second shot, and it was with the same exact contractor, but it was at a different site. It was the San Francisco International Airport rental car facility they were building, and This employer did the same thing. He worked me 585 hours and laid me off 15 hours shy of completing the 600-hour requirement. So that's where the two more years of my life were spent between those long layoffs and those short 5.5 months of labor.
You have such an even temperament, apparently, from knowing you now for an hour. Was there a point when you were just, like, getting ready to, like, slash some tires or, you know?
Yeah. I have to say I went back into the carpentry trade, and I was working on a project. San Francisco Museum of Modern Art was being built, and I saw a woman in coveralls working next to the elevators. And I went over there, and I said, oh, my God, are you working on elevators? She goes, yeah, heck yeah. And I go, how the heck did you get into this? I've been trying for almost 5-6 years to get into this. And she said, well, who have you been talking to? And I told her my little story there. And she said, oh, girl, come with me. I got stories to tell you. So I went with her, and she told me that the whole time I was trying to get on that female elevator mechanic wanted sign at those north and south towers in the federal building in Oakland, she was on that project, she and four other women, and they had been so sexually harassed by their own coworkers that they had to file a lawsuit, and they filed a class action lawsuit against the employer and against the union because the union didn't defend them against the on-the-job harassment they were getting. Now, keep in mind, elevators are close quarters, very tight spaces of working, and a mechanic is the leader on the project, and he works with a helper who's the assistant. And so it's the two are required by the union to work together. And these ladies were in these close-quarter situations behind closed doors, basically, elevator closed doors, and these men were harassing them, and they had no recourse but to try and sue because every day.
Wow.
And I had no idea this lawsuit was going on and why I was being strung along for those 5 years until I realized it was because the employer had this lawsuit against them and they had a bad taste for women and they didn't want to hire any more.
And the definition of sexual harassment isn't necessarily someone's making an unwanted sexual advance, which may or may not have happened. It can also be being said, oh, you do that like a girl. Hey, you know, if you were a man, you'd do this better. I mean, it's sexual discrimination that's manifested in act and speech and deed. So, you know, it's not like these guys were necessarily groping the women, although they may have been. They could have just been completely denigrating them every day at work. Like if you were a black person working with a white person who turned around and said, hey, N-word, go pick that up. Hey, N-word, you know, that's harassment. So, you know, I just want to throw that in because a lot of times people say, well, women make that up, you know, and you don't have to make up people just treating you like crap. And then we can all imagine being treated like crap by someone, you know. And you have to be careful that you're not treated by crap. If you're going to treat somebody like crap, well, for God's sakes, don't be a sexist or a racist about it. Treat everybody like crap.
There you go. Yeah. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with L.J. Dolden. We're in Roswell, New Mexico, home of the aliens, talking to the person who won't tell us where the alien elevator is, which I'm still going to get it. We're going to get it out of you one way or another. We have techniques.
Well, I have a couple of quick questions about that. Sheriff Joe Arpaio, did he come in through that elevator?
Did my mother-in-law come in through that elevator?
How about Governor LePage from Maine or Governor Corbett from Pennsylvania?
There
Has
you
anyone
go.
Seen, are they hatchlings out of that elevator?
You haven't seen it yet. Moves faster than the speed of light.
There you go.
Well, none of them do, so that can't be it.
Can you send my mother-in-law back?
Ooh. We better take that break.
You better at some point. So let's move into Roswell. What brought you from California to Roswell? I mean, you know, there's a point at which now you're into the union, into the job. You're doing this in California. What brings you back to New Mexico?
Well, I had a little stint in New England between the two places. I wanted to say, you know, one of the reasons I had such a hard time getting into the elevator trade was because they had no apprenticeship program in their trade. And that's how I figured out they were keeping the doors closed to women and minorities and only hiring mostly family members. So I got really mad, like she asked me, did you ever get really mad? I got really mad when I met this woman at the Museum of Modern Art and she explained to me. So I went down to every politician's office who would listen to me. And
hell hath no fury.
Yes. And I got public speaking engagements at all the city council meetings in San Francisco. I went to the human rights organization there, and I stood up at meetings. Now, see, these ladies that filed this lawsuit, the first thing that the opposition did was try to settle with each one of them out of court so they could split the class up and get rid of this thing. It was a bad thing for them.
And, of course, gag it.
Right. But the ladies got some non-monetary gains in this lawsuit, too. And one of those was they were court-ordered by a judge to receive the EEO3 report, which is the makeup of the union itself there in San Francisco. It shows how many blacks, whites, female, males, Indians, all minorities. And I would take a copy of that form because these were now my friends, these ladies, and I'd go down to Human Rights and I'd put it up on the overhead display and I'd say, this is the makeup of this labor union in this city where you award billions of dollars of contracts every year and they will not hire women or minorities. Look at their numbers. And then this kept going on. I kept doing this. I'd go to Sacramento and do the same thing there. And sometimes my friend from the museum that I met would join me in this effort. And we just wouldn't shut up about it. And I just kept telling them, until you make this trade, put an elevator apprenticeship program in, they're not going to do anything. Well, one year they were celebrating, the trade there in San Francisco was celebrating their 100th year anniversary. And it made for a great talking point to stand up and say, they have now successfully existed for 100 years. They're the only and the last trade to put in apprenticeship program. Every other trade had one but the elevator constructors. So now's time you make them do it. And that was about the year 1998-99. And I decided to leave in the year 2000 right when I got news that they were forcing them to put an elevator apprenticeship program together. I fell in love and I moved to New England. And as I arrived in New England, the apprenticeship program went into full force. And I had moved my way through the only education program that they had in the elevator trade at the time. And when I arrived in New England, I was an apprentice, an official apprentice for 1 week. And I had to sign on the dotted line that I was an apprentice, and they had no idea that I was the person that helped force this into being. And 1 week later, I took my mechanics exam and passed it and became a mechanic. So I was only an apprentice on paper for 7 days or so, and then I became a mechanic.
Good for you.
Yeah.
You know, this is great. And the part I'm taking away from this that is the upside, because it's a pretty awful story, the upside is, the woman that you met that was working on the elevator in the art museum, she was a member of the union?
Yes, her name is Jennifer Stafford, and she had been in the union and part of the lawsuit, and she eventually had to file another one, too. And she's made history herself in the elevator trade. She was a member of the IUEC Local Number 8 of San Francisco.
But she kept her job. That wouldn't happen in any, if she hadn't been a member of a union. You know what? She'd be flipping burgers somewhere right this very. Her question would be, "Would you like to supersize that right this very minute?" If she had not been a labor union,
no prize with that.
She went on a speaking tour to talk about the bad stuff the union was doing to her, and she did her job. That's remarkable.
Well, I have to tell you, we were trying to keep this under the cool. You know, we didn't want to be the poster child for how this happened, but every politician who would listen to us, we went to them. And I remember one day specifically, in Sacramento, there was this huge labor gathering of all the labor heads of the whole entire state. And they had, Governor Gray Davis of California had just appointed Marcy Saunders as head of the labor, Secretary of Labor over in the state. And Marcy walked in to the room in this field of just union guys. And she was wearing a bright yellow suit. No one could miss her. And she saw Jennifer and I standing at the back of the room, and she was supposed to go up to the podium and give a keynote speech. And she saw us standing back there, and she came back there before she took the podium, and she said, "Is there something you ladies want?" And we said, "Yes, to speak with you in private." So she left the auditorium and took us into a private room. She said, "What is it you ladies want?" We said, "We want you to make the elevator trade put an apprenticeship program in." And she said, "Okay." And she walked out. And from that day on is when I think it really started to change.
Did you ever feel like giving up?
Oh, yeah, many times. One of those layoffs I spoke about, I ended up living in my car for 6 months in San Francisco. And I parked it on one street, and every night I had to move it to the other side of the street. And I used my motorcycle as my transportation to get to and from work. But I lived in my car for 6 months, so broke, trying to, you know, they laid me off. And it's such an awful time trying to get into the trade. So I kept up with it, though, because I wanted it really bad.
That's fantastic. I feel like I've just met, like, Susan B. Anthony, for crying out loud.
Yeah, it's an amazing story.
You know? That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
I mean, there's so many great themes to the story.
So what brought me back to Roswell is that my grandmother turned 90 and now is 97, and I just wanted to spend more time with her as I could. My whole family is here.
And you were able to just transfer here? And
yeah. Well, when you finally earn your union card, which is when I, you know, finally got through that probation period and got my union card, means I can go anywhere in the world and work on elevators because we're an international union. Primarily, I want to stick to the United States, but I have worked in San Francisco with my card, where I gained my card, and I worked in New England with my card, and then I transferred out here to New Mexico and worked with my card. And when I first got here, they didn't make it easy on me. They sent me to Colorado, which is very far from home. They sent me to Lubbock 2 years, and I've been like a transient worker for a long time. But I always had my eye on getting into the service side of the elevator industry, which means I wasn't installing them anymore. I was actually maintaining them.
Right.
And that's a whole, it's still the same union, but it's a whole other way of looking at elevators, troubleshooting problems, working with electronics. So
you're the one who gets me out when I make sure I don't get stuck,
right,
as I have had happen a couple of times. So last question, the elevator to the aliens, not going to tell me, are you?
No, I can't tell you at this time.
The kids will be so disappointed.
At this time, but you know what I hear? If you step into it, you'll know it then.
All right, quick break. LJ, thank you so much. It was great talking with you. Thanks for taking time for us. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show from Roswell, New Mexico.
Hi, I'm Rick Smith.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Thanks for listening to this encore performance of our People's Tour for America.
Gee, Rick, just listening to the show makes me feel warmer.
Funny, Pat. I feel warmer, too.
Oh, Rick, you should feel warmer. You're in Florida right now on vacation with Carol and the kids.
That's right. But we'll be back after the new year with all new shows and some biting commentary for election year 2014.
I know I speak for everyone when I say I just can't wait.
The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federal federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
In the factories and the fields, in the city streets and the quiet country towns.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So as we wrap up another day on the road, another day of the People's Tour for America. Again, if you missed any portion of our coverage of our tour, therickSmithShow.com or PeoplesTourForAmerica.com, the podcasts are there, the pictures. So much information, so much of what we've seen, Pat. And, you know, as I go back over tonight's program, you think about the Bush Library or the Library Propaganda Center. You think about the horrible tragedy in West. We didn't even get to talk about the grassy knoll and the iron worker that we met who gave us a kind of an impromptu tour and, you know, a little guided commentary.
Wasn't that something? I mean, it was just amazing to be wandering around the school book depository, way too overpriced.
What is it with $16? Is everything $16 now?
Yes. Everything that isn't $100. And so he's like, well, you're not taking your family in there unless you're a rich man. And then he said that he had hurt his back and he'd been out. And so he was just getting back to work and he was a tour guide. And he was going to try a shtick on us. And at first I'm thinking, yeah, right. But no, it was all true. And he was a former iron worker, which was a nice little serendipity.
Interesting twist.
Yeah. And then he really knew his stuff. And he had such an alliterative way of speaking. It was so enjoyable to hear him talk. And I think, Sam was really captivated by him because he was just so knowledgeable and yet talking about such very difficult things.
And the thing that struck me as he goes, because very little offends me, unless you're talking about taking food out of the mouths of children or killing people with drones or, you know,
yeah,
some of the things we saw at the Bush Library. He was very, very clear and very lucid in his position. You may not agree with him, you may agree with him, but, you know, he put it on the line, and I respect that.
Yeah, he said, you know, the government subsidizes the sixth floor museum where it's alleged, and he said alleged, and I say alleged too, alleged that Lee Harvey Oswald shot and killed John Kennedy. But he said, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. The magic bullet is just absolutely ridiculous. How it can go in and out and in and out of Kennedy and Connolly and one bullet, you know, shattering wrists and shattering thighs and then, you know, blowing somebody's head open. Just kind of seems a little crazy. And, you know, then he took us to the grassy knoll and showed us really a vantage point that I could have thrown a rock and hit the president.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
and you look at that site, though, and, you know, as someone who, you know, your job is to protect the most powerful man in the world, why would you have allowed that route to happen? You know, as I stood there looking at it, I'm going, this is a because when you see it on the video, my entire life was only seeing really the Zapruder film and a couple of the others. It looks huge. It looks wide open and spacious. But when you get into and you stand there, it is the perfect ambush site.
It really was, but he did, you mean the grassy knoll was a perfect, yeah, absolutely, especially because there's a picket fence there, just perfect, hide behind the picket fence. But
well, even if you think that the shot came from the book depository, that angle is a perfect angle. The grassy knoll. I could even buy the theory that the shot came from the sewer because it's right there.
Yeah, I agree with him though. I think if a shot had come from the sewer, it would have had to have come up through the grill of the vehicle, and you know that. I don't think that anybody came out of the sewer to shoot him, but I did think that another point he made about Lee Harvey Oswald that was excellent was he turned onto Elm Street. So for a while, Lee Harvey Oswald, instead of having to shoot him from an angle off to the side, could have shot him dead center, head on, right staring at him. Because for a while, the motorcade was driving toward the school book depository. And he didn't squeeze a shot off, and you know I think Lee Harvey Oswald was a stooge, and Jack Ruby takes him out live on television. That's kind of crazy too.
For me, it was an opportunity, something once in a lifetime, something I'd always wanted to do.
No,
I always
meant Jack Ruby shooting him.
I always wanted to stand on that ground.
Yeah, me too.
And, you know, throughout my whole life, I wanted to see that. And part of this tour gave me the opportunity to do that. And I think, you know, the experiential learning that goes on with things like this is so important to how you view things. And, you know, I'm a little more skeptical now than I was probably, you know, a couple of days ago.
Wow. That's a big deal.
No, I mean, I've always been very skeptical. I rarely believe what you put right in front of me. But in looking at that, you know, it's a little different.
Yeah. Well, I'm, you know, a lot of this trip is just plain everyday old hard work, which both you and I enjoy working hard, but that just seemed like a vacation day. It was a treat to be able to go do that. I also have wanted to do that. My birthday is John Kennedy Jr. and I were born a couple of hours apart. Same year, same everything. And so my mom, my Irish-American mom, was just a huge Kennedy fan, and she was always just so sort of delighted by this coincidence of my birthday and John Jr.'s birthday. And so, you know, this Kennedy folklore lived larger than life in my house. And from the time I was about 10, I would send John Jr. a birthday card. You know,
wow.
It's a big coincidence, I know. So, I mean, from the time I was about 10, I was fascinated with this family and this little coincidental kid. And I have, you know, we went to Washington, D.C. every April to see my uncle who worked at the Pentagon when I was a kid. And we went to see the eternal flame over Kennedy's grave and Bobby Kennedy's grave right next to it. And it's just always fascinated me. And literally since I was, you know, grammar school, I have wanted to go to Dallas. And so it was really a treat to be able to actually get there.
Yeah, it was an excellent opportunity. And, you know, everything, so far, everything we've done have been things that I've wanted to do. And looking forward, you know, we're gonna go to the Grand Canyon, going to do the Hoover Dam into Los Angeles to talk about, you know, labor history there. You know, I'm looking forward to the coming days. Looking forward to Portland. I've never been to Portland, so I'm looking forward to the opportunity to reach out and engage people and talk about and learn from folks.
Yeah, and this is such a gigantic country, and really, you've been a truck driver. It's not like you've had your shoes nailed to the floor. And I've certainly traveled a lot, but we're still seeing things that neither one of us have ever seen before, and you wonder how many trips around the country you could do before you ran out of new stuff.
I don't think you could ever run out of new stuff in this country. I think there's so much. And look, I would love to have this be a yearly road tour.
That'd be fun.
That would be absolutely fantastic. And again, if you've missed any portion of our tour, TheRickSmithShow.com or PeoplesTourForAmerica.com, all of the interviews we've done, all of the places we've been, and where we're going, also there at the site. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, or you can email pat@thericksmithshow.com as well. We do answer all emails personally. Look forward to your inputs, your thoughts, your questions, comments, what you liked, what you didn't like. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off.